I'm the son of a black man from Kenya and a white woman from Kansas. I was raised with the help of a white grandfather who survived a depression to serve in Patton's army during World War II, and a wild white grandmother who worked on a bomber assembly line at Fort Leavenworth while he was overseas. I've gone to some of the best schools in America, and I've lived in one of the world's poorest nations. I am married to a black American who carries within her the blood of slaves and slave owners, an inheritance we pass on to our two precious daughters. I have brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, uncles, and cousins of every race and every hue scattered across three continents. And for as long as I live, I will never forget that in no other country on earth is my story even possible. It's a story that hasn't made me the most conventional of candidates, but it is a story that has seared into my genetic makeup the idea that this nation is more than the sum of its parts, that out of many, we are truly one. Now, throughout the first year of this campaign, against all predictions to the contrary, we saw how hungry the American people were for this message of unity. Despite the temptation to view my candidacy through a purely racial lens, we won commanding victories in states with some of the whitest populations in the country. In South Carolina, where the Confederate flag still flies, we built a powerful coalition of African Americans and white Americans. This is not to say that race has not been an issue in this campaign. At various stages in the campaign, some commentators have deemed me either too black or not black enough. We saw racial tensions bubble to the surface during the week before the South Carolina primary. The press has scoured every single exit poll for the latest evidence of racial polarization, not just in terms of white and black, but black and brown as well. And yet, it's only been in the last couple of weeks that the discussion of race in this campaign has taken a particularly divisive turn. On one end of the spectrum, we've heard the implication that my candidacy is somehow an exercise in affirmative action, that is based solely on the desire of wild and wide-eyed liberals to purchase racial reconciliation on the cheap. On the other end, we've heard my former pastor, Jeremiah Wright, use incendiary language to express views that have the potential not only to widen the racial divide, but views that denigrate both the greatness and the goodness of our nation, and that rightly offend white and black alike. I have already condemned in unequivocal terms the statements of Reverend Wright that have caused such controversy and in some cases pain. For some, nagging questions remain. Did I know him to be an occasionally fierce critic of American domestic and foreign policy? Of course. Did I ever hear him make remarks that could be considered controversial while I sat in the church? Yes. Did I strongly disagree with many of his political views? Absolutely. Just as I'm sure many of you have heard remarks from your pastors, priests, or rabbis with which you strongly disagree. But the remarks that have caused this recent firestorm weren't simply controversial. They weren't simply a religious leader's efforts to speak out against perceived injustice. Instead, they expressed a profoundly distorted view of this country, a view that sees white racism as endemic and that elevates what is wrong with America above all that we know is right with America, a view that sees the conflicts in the Middle East as rooted primarily in the actions of stalwart allies like Israel, instead of emanating from the perverse and hateful ideologies of radical Islam. As such, Reverend Wright's comments were not only wrong, but divisive. Divisive at a time when we need unity, racially charged at a time when we need to come together to solve a set of monumental problems. Two wars, a terrorist threat, a falling economy, a chronic healthcare crisis, and potentially devastating climate change. Problems that are neither black or white or Latino or Asian, but rather problems that confront us all. Given my background, my politics, and my professed values and ideals, there will no doubt be those for whom my statements of condemnation are not enough. Why associate myself with Reverend Wright in the first place, they may ask? Why not join another church? And I confess that if all that I knew of Reverend Wright were the snippets of those sermons that have run in an endless loop on the television sets and YouTube, if Trinity United Church of Christ conformed to the caricatures being peddled by some commentators, there is no doubt that I would react in much the same way. But the truth is, that isn't all that I know of the man. The man I met more than 20 years ago is a man who helped introduce me to my Christian faith, a man who spoke to me about our obligations to love one another, to care for the sick, and lift up the poor. He is a man who served his country as a United States Marine, and who has studied and lectured at some of the finest universities and seminaries in the country, and who over 30 years has led a church that serves the community by doing God's work here on earth, by housing the homeless, ministering to the needy, providing daycare services and scholarships and prison ministries, and reaching out to those suffering from HIV/AIDS.
HIV discriminates.
In my first book, Dreams for My Father, I describe the experience of my first service at Trinity. It goes as follows. People began to shout, to rise from their seats and clap and cry out, a forceful wind carrying the Reverend's voice up to the rafters. And in that single note, hope, I heard something else. At the foot of that cross inside the thousands of churches across the city, I imagine the stories of ordinary black people merging with the stories of David and Goliath, Moses and Pharaoh, the Christians in the lion's den, Ezekiel's field of dry bones. Those stories of survival and freedom and hope became our stories, my story. The blood that spilled was our blood, the tears our tears, until this black church on this bright day seemed once more a vessel carrying the story of a people into future generations and into a larger world. Our trials and triumphs became at once unique and universal, black and more than black. In chronicling our journey, the stories and songs gave us a meaning to reclaim memories that we didn't need to feel shame about, memories that all people might study and cherish and with which we could start to rebuild. That has been my experience at Trinity. Like other predominantly black churches across the country, Trinity embodies the black community in its entirety, the doctor and the welfare mom, the model student and the former gangbanger. Like other black churches, Trinity's services are full of raucous laughter and sometimes bawdy humor. They are full of dancing and clapping and screaming and shouting that may seem jarring to the untrained ear. The church contains in full the kindness and cruelty, the fierce intelligence and the shocking ignorance, the struggles and successes, the love and, yes, the bitterness and biases that make up the black experience in America. And this helps explain, perhaps, my relationship with Reverend Wright. As imperfect as he may be, he has been like family to me. He strengthened my faith, officiated my wedding, and baptized my children. Not once in my conversations with him have I heard him talk about any ethnic group in derogatory terms, or treat whites with whom he interacted with anything but courtesy and respect. He contains within him the contradictions, the good and the bad, of the community that he has served diligently for so many years. I can no more disown him than I can disown the black community. I can no more disown him than I can disown my white grandmother a woman who helped raise me, a woman who sacrificed again and again for me, a woman who loves me as much as she loves anything in this world, but a woman who once confessed her fear of black men who passed her by on the street, and who on more than one occasion has uttered racial or ethnic stereotypes that made me cringe. These people are part of me, and they are part of America, this country that I love. Now, some will see this as an attempt to justify or excuse comments that are simply inexcusable. I can assure you it is not. And I suppose the politically safe thing to do would be to move on from this episode and just hope that it fades into the woodwork. We can dismiss Reverend Wright as a crank or a demagogue, just as some have dismissed Geraldine Ferraro in the aftermath of her recent statements as harboring some deep-seated bias. But race is an issue that I believe this nation cannot afford to ignore right now. We would be making the same mistake that Reverend Wright made in his offending sermons about America, to simplify and stereotype and amplify the negative to the point that it distorts reality.
Context of white supremacy. Justice, Gus T. Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully, to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, October 26th, Friday, 2012. So I have been told. We will be back. We will have programs all weekend. We will be broadcasting on Saturday the compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Dial in. Looking forward to hearing from non-white people. If you've been having workplace problems or triumphs, dial in. Share if you've been doing experiments, if you have been, you've come up with some new codified concepts, thoughts, suggestions, codified techniques, dial in and share. Always a pleasure to hear from less confused non-white people for the Saturday call-in program. Definitely going to take some time to review what's been going on with child rapist Jimmy Savile, suspected racist, former employee at the BBC, been a huge news story over in the UK for most of this week. It is, just save that for tomorrow. If you're on my Facebook page, facebook.com/ The Problem Is White People. I've been posting links to the videos. They have documentaries on this. They've been covering it on the BBC radio program. It is, in my view, it's even worse than what happened with Jerry Sandusky. More on that tomorrow. Sunday, our guest will be black female author Renethia Tate. Her book, Pieces of a Puzzle. Wow. I mean, you talk about sexual trauma. Wow. This book, Pam, she references it. Pam was instrumental in me being able to get her on the program. Would not have happened without Pam's assistance. Hang on one second.
This conference is being recorded.
Double checking. So it wouldn't have been possible without Pam's assistance. But she goes into great detail. The author, Ms. Tate, she has read Mr. Fuller's work. She's talked to Mr. Fuller repeatedly. She is a lot less confused about white supremacy, racism, and her book is just about her research. She studied, she interviewed, and analyzed data of several black females who admitted to being in sexual relationships with white men. She also interviewed several white men who admitted to being sexually involved or wanting to be sexually involved with black non-white females. It is a fascinating book. Definitely tune in this Sunday evening, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Renethia Tate, If I can carve out a section of time, I will share a little bit from the book. I'll put it on my blog and Facebook so you can get an idea of what you will be in store for. Wow. Don't want to miss it. This Sunday, if you have any, I would say if you have female offspring, tell them to tune in and listen. If you have black females that you're concerned about, if they're in your family, friends, maybe even some black females who are thinking about pursuing a white man sexually, have them check out that broadcast this Sunday. Miss Tate, she even goes into her own experience in being sexually trashed by a white man this Sunday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, context of white supremacy. Okay, this program, we are doing study session number one. Put it on your Facebook, tweet it. The election, big season, everyone's talking about who they're going to vote for and their displeasure with President Obama, the lynchings, the watermelons, calling him a retard. Let folks know we're doing our study session. They can tune in from the very beginning. Audiobook analysis of Dreams from My Father, President Barack Obama. A couple things that I will get in before we do the first segment. For folks who don't know, the way we do the book club sessions, number one, these are supposed to be like book clubs, participation. So if you're out there listening, be thinking, you know, that you want to participate. You want to chime in. This is not just, you know, we'll sit back and listen to see what Gus thinks. This is supposed to be us communicating, exchanging views and ideas. What we think, you know, is being communicated in the book. So take notes, have a pen and pad handy, maybe. You can write down some notes, or if you got a good memory, just make some mental notes about what you think, what you hear. As the book rolls by, read by President Barack Obama. One quick note, I'm a little bit unhappy. When we do audiobooks, I think this is the third audiobook that we've done now, I think. I try to get the unabridged version. That means that you get the audiobook where they have not redacted anything, they haven't edited anything out. You are getting the entire book just as if you were going to get the hard copy, right? This is the abridged version. They do not have an unabridged audiobook of Dreams from My Father. I'm really bummed about that. I looked. It seems that many people are upset about that. That is important. The audiobook is 5 CDs. The actual hard copy, the unabridged hard copy, is a little over 500 pages. So just, I guess, to give you some scale, Toni Morrison, The Bluest Eye, that was 5 audio cassettes. So I think that would probably be about in the range of 4 or 5 CDs. And that was about a 200 page book. So I suspect that if they did an unabridged version, it would be significantly longer than what we have. 5 discs, it would probably be in the neighborhood of 10, maybe even more than that, audio discs if they did the complete unabridged version. So there's a lot that they took out that is noteworthy, in my view. I will have to follow along. I have read this book before, but it's been a while. I read this book in 2008. I was less confused. I read this book after I read the code book. I had spoke with Mr. Fuller. The Cow started in 2007, so I was less confused when I read this book, but it's been, you know, 4 years. So I'm going to go back and try to pick out if there are things that they took out, things that are not in the audiobook that are only in the hard copy. I'll try to go back and insert those as we roll along, but that is definitely something I will be reminding folks. This is not the full book. This is the abridged version, and if you're really a studious, maybe get the hard copy and kind of flip through, because I'm sure there are some things that will be left out that are noteworthy. And I will say, if there was an available unabridged version, that's the version we'd be listening to. That's it. One of the quick ground rules that I wanted to touch on, and then I'll have a quick comment about the audio that we started with, and then we'll get to the book. Quick ground rules. This, you know, is a book club, right? So it is about the book that we're on. If there are parallels, if there are things that are brought up in the book that relate to things that are happening right now, or relate to something that, you know, President Obama did or something that you observed, that's fine. But we're not really looking for a lot of tangents, just because, you know, this was brought up in the book and this will give me an opportunity to talk in detail about something that happened that is not in the book. We really want to try to stay on task because I think there's a lot here to think about, analyze. What does this mean? How is this relevant to the system of white supremacy? So that's number one. Second thing, I definitely am not using this as an expose on the victim of racism, President Barack Obama. He is not white. I have not heard, I can only think of one person who made an attempt or even suggested that President Obama might be a white person. I've only heard one person do that. They did not present any evidence. So yeah, other than that, I can't think of anyone who even tries to say that we're talking about someone other than a victim of racism, President Barack Obama. That being said, he's not in charge. You got to be white to be a racist white supremacist. The problem is white people. So this is not about looking for evidence to go on attack against President Obama and a gotcha moment. See, I knew that no good Negro. It's not about that. It's not about trying to find out who his real father is. I know people have talked about dreams of my real father and Frank Marshall Davis is his father. Malcolm X is his father and yada, yada, yada. I have no interest in that at all. Zero. In fact, when I hear all of that about who President Obama's father is from anyone, white person or a non-white person, it is revolting. And really, that's the wrong R word. It's not revolting. It is racist. It's stale racist operating procedure to be talking about we don't know who this Negro's father is. I mean, that is so old. White people's one of their favorite racist jokes that they've been passing down for centuries. What is the most confusing holiday in the ghetto? Father's Day. I mean, it's stale racism. It's like we might as well just wheel President Obama out on Jerry Springer or Ricky Lake and have him do a paternity test. I mean, it's embarrassing. I've never heard any white president where there is intense, ongoing dialogue. Who is his dad? Who is his dad? And for me, since we are talking about a non-white person, a victim of racism, it's like when I hear black people doing this, it's like us sitting around looking at a slave on the ship and saying, wait a minute now, that slave over there in the corner with the rusty shackles, that one, his dad is really such and such and such and such. And I want to make sure that everybody has that straight right now. His dad, slave right there, stop saying that his dad is John because his dad is really Fred. Now, we got that understood? Now, let's everybody sit down. That's about what it sounds like to me, hearing a lot of non-white people get really excited talking about, you know, who they think this person's father is. I don't know, and I don't think getting that information is going to help us replace white supremacy with justice. I could be wrong. I could be wrong. But I mean, it's so stale and racist. It just sounds like the sort of thing that white people just throw out their tacky and trifling racism, and we pick it up and run with it. So just to make sure, that's not what this study session is about at all. Also, I would say just in terms of codification, I don't think there should be non-white people, and this is just about being correct with terms, right? I don't think there should be non-white people, if we're trying to be precise, should be saying that President Barack Obama, his father is such and such and such and such, or his father is not such and such and such and such. Reason being, I could be wrong, but I don't think there are any non-white people out there who have a paternity test that they've conducted on President Obama or whomever that they think his father is or his mom is. I don't think there are any non-white people who are holding DNA evidence in their hand. I think most of the time what they got is a book that they read or a film that they saw. I think most folks in a court of law, that would be labeled hearsay. You got to have evidence. This is not about taking sides or what. It's just about being precise with terms. You want to be careful about what you're saying. Precise. And making sure that you're not saying anything that you cannot evidence. I think the correct way, just about being precise with terms, I think the correct way to go about it would be, if you have these suspicions, to say, I am suspicious about what I have been told. It is reported in da 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 da, and I would cite where you're getting this information, because you don't want to contribute to a lot of unnecessary rumors. Like I said before, I don't think any of this is relevant, but just cleaning up the language. Non-white people definitely should not be going around proclaiming that they know who such and such is father. I mean, unless you got evidence, unless you were in the bedroom, you saw the sexual act go down, you knew that there was conception, you waited the 9 months, unless you got hard evidence, unless you got a paternity test, something of that nature, just be careful with the way that that gets phrased. Moving on from that, focusing on the book, not about demonizing President Obama, definitely not trying to find who his father is in these study sessions. All right, quickly, the audio clip that we heard at the beginning of the program, the More Perfect Union address, that is 2008. He was not president at the time. That was in March of 2008. He had not even secured the Democratic nomination at the time. He was still in a fierce battle with now Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in the battle for president in 2008. I did not think President Obama was going to win the election up until that moment. I had been telling everybody he's not going to win up until I heard that speech in March of 2008. Hearing that speech made me change my mind. I think that is probably one of the most important speeches that has been given in this area of the world in the last 5 years. I think that speech right there got him the White House. It's about a 35-minute speech. You just heard about 10 minutes of it. In fact, I think it's so important, we should probably listen to the whole 37 or 35-minute speech at some point. It is incredible. Just the 10 minutes that you heard should have been fascinating for many reasons. Just the messages. That's why I said, that's what I want to do with the book. That's what I think would be most informative. What is this book communicating to white people? What messages are being communicated to white people in this book? Because I think that's the audience. I don't think this book was intended for non-white people. I could be wrong. I could be wrong. We can talk about that as we go as well. But I think this book was for white people. That speech that you heard at the beginning, I think, was for white people. What messages have to be communicated to white people if you are going to have a non-white person in the position holding the title of President of the United States? I think that's something that's very important to keep in mind, both during the election this time around and as we read the book. Just for folks who watch the debate, I know Sister Lalisha is not in that crowd, but for people who watch the debates and or the Democratic National Convention, patterns, oh my, oh my. I don't know if you watched the third debate, but they spent a lot of time talking about Israel. I think Israel came up in that speech you just heard, the more perfect union address. Oh my, just so many of the similarities. Even I found it astonishing. It had been, oh, I think it had been more than a year since I'd heard this speech last. And when I was listening to it, I was like, wow, he actually picks up and starts reading from Dreams of My Father. And I just said, that is incredible. Like when I think last week I was saying, President Obama, this is a well put together package. I would say that speech right there is an example of what I'm talking about. Racist white supremacists put together an impeccable package to showcase, in my view, to showcase a non-white person, have them look like they are in charge. Incredible, where you can have a non-white person come out and have to address these allegations that you've got this black pastor who is attacking white people and saying all this stuff, talking about racism, white supremacy, to have to come out and address all that. And he can do it calmly, eloquently, and can even pick up his best-selling autobiography, which just coincidentally happens to have information that is right on this topic. I mean, it. Anyway, without further ado, this is Dreams from My Father. As I said, it is about 5 discs. This is the abridged version, so we are missing some details, unfortunately, but this is what we got. I will supplement as we go. And if anyone out there, I definitely encourage, if you have read the book or if you're kind of reading it now as we go through this, if there are sections in the book that you think are important, definitely highlight it, share. That would be great. I'll pitch that out and remind people as we go. If you got the book, if you got the hard copy, I'm going to do that myself. If you see things that are not in the audiobook as you're kind of going along and you see, oh, they omitted that, definitely chime in. We'll kind of keep note and see if we can observe some patterns of things that were left out of the audiobook that are actually in the unabridged version. So keep that in mind as we roll. President Barack Obama reading his autobiography, Dreams from My Father, published in 2005, without further ado. This is the first section. It is approximately 35 minutes. We'll play the full clip, and then once it ends, we will get to the phone lines and see what people have to say. I'll give out the number and all that, but we got about 30, 35 minutes or so. So prop up your feet, relax, enjoy. President Obama, Dreams from My Father, context of white supremacy.
Random House Audio presents Dreams from My Father, a story of race and inheritance by Barack Obama. Read for you by the author.
Almost a decade has passed since this book was first published. The opportunity to write the book came when I was in law school, the result of my election as the first African-American president of the Harvard Law Review. In the wake of some modest publicity, I received an advance from a publisher and went to work with the belief that the story of my family and my efforts to understand that story might speak in some way to the fissures of race that have characterized the American experience, as well as the fluid state of identity, the leaps through time, the collision of cultures that mark our modern life. Like most first-time authors, I was filled with hope and despair upon the book's publication. Hope that the book might succeed beyond my youthful dreams, despair that I had failed to say anything worth saying. The reality fell somewhere in between. The reviews were mildly favorable. People actually showed up at the readings that my publisher arranged. The sales were underwhelming. And after a few months, I went on with the business of my life, certain that my career as an author would be short-lived, but glad to have survived the process with my dignity more or less intact. I had little time for reflection over the next 10 years. I ran a voter registration project in the 1992 election cycle, began a civil rights practice, and started teaching constitutional law at the University of Chicago. My wife and I bought a house, were blessed with 2 gorgeous, healthy, and mischievous daughters, and struggled to pay the bills. When a seat in the state legislature opened up in 1996, some friends persuaded me to run for the office, and I won. I had been warned before taking office that state politics lacks the glamour of its Washington counterpart. One labors largely in obscurity, mostly on topics that mean a great deal to some, but that the average man or woman on the street can safely ignore. The regulation of mobile homes, say, or the tax consequences of farm equipment depreciation. Nevertheless, I found the work satisfying,
mostly because the scale of state politics allows for concrete results, an expansion of health insurance for poor children, or a reform of the laws that send innocent men to death row, within a meaningful time frame. And two, because within the Capitol building of a big industrial state, one sees every day the face of a nation in constant conversation. Inner-city mothers and corn and bean farmers, immigrant day laborers alongside suburban investment bankers, all jostling to be heard, all ready to tell their stories. A few months ago, I won a seat as the United States Senator from Illinois. It was a difficult race in a crowded field of well-funded, skilled, and prominent candidates. Without organizational backing or personal wealth, a black man with a funny name, I was considered a long shot. And so when I won, garnering a majority of votes in white areas as well as black, in the suburbs as well as Chicago, the reaction that followed echoed the response to my election to the Law Review. Mainstream commentators expressed genuine hope that my victory signaled a broader change in our racial politics. Within the black community, there is a sense of pride regarding my accomplishment, a pride mingled with frustration that 50 years after Brown v. Board of Education and 40 years after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, we should still be celebrating the fact that I am the sole African American, and only the third since Reconstruction, to serve in the Senate. My family, friends, and I are mildly bewildered by the attention, and constantly aware of the gulf between the hard sheen of media reports and the messy, mundane realities of life as it is truly lived. Just as that spate of publicity prompted my publisher's interest a decade ago, so has this fresh round of news clippings encouraged the book's republication. For the first time in many years, I've pulled out a copy and read a few chapters to see how much my voice may have changed over time. I confess to wincing ever so often at a poorly chosen word, a mangled sentence, an expression of emotion that seems indulgent or overly practiced. But I cannot honestly say that the voice in this book is not mine, that I would tell the story much differently today than I did 10 years ago, even if certain passages have proven to be inconvenient politically, the grist for political commentary and opposition research. What has changed, of course, dramatically, decisively, is the context in which the book might now be read. I began writing against a backdrop of Silicon Valley and a booming stock market, the collapse of the Berlin Wall, Mandela, in slow, sturdy steps, emerging from prison to lead a country, the signing of peace accords in Oslo. Domestically, our cultural debates around guns and abortion and rap lyrics seemed so fierce precisely because Bill Clinton's third way, a scaled-back welfare state without grand ambition but without sharp edges, seemed to describe a broad underlying consensus on bread-and-butter issues, a consensus to which even George W. Bush's first campaign, with its compassionate conservatism, would have to give a nod. Internationally, writers announced the end of history, the ascendance of free markets and liberal democracy, the replacement of old hatreds and wars between nations, with virtual communities and battles for market share. And then, on September 11th, 2001, the world fractured. It's beyond my skill as a writer to capture that day and the days that would follow. The planes, like specters, vanishing into steel and glass, the slow-motion cascade of towers crumbling into themselves, the ash-covered figures wandering the streets, the anguish and the fear. Nor do I pretend to understand the stark nihilism that drove the terrorists that day and that drives their brethren still. My powers of empathy, my ability to reach into another's heart, cannot penetrate the blank stares of those who would murder innocence with abstract, serene satisfaction. What I do know is that history returned that day with a vengeance, that in fact, as Faulkner reminds us, the past is never dead and buried. It isn't even past. This collective history, this past, directly touches my own. Not merely because the bombs of Al-Qaeda have marked, with an eerie precision, some of the landscapes of my life, the buildings and roads and faces of Nairobi, Bali, Manhattan. Not merely because, as a consequence of 9/11, my name is an irresistible target of mocking websites from overzealous Republican operatives. But also because the underlying struggle between worlds of plenty and worlds of want, between the modern and the ancient, between those who embrace our teeming, colliding, irksome diversity, while still insisting on a set of values that binds us together, and those who would seek, under whatever flag or slogan or sacred text, a certainty and simplification that justifies cruelty toward those not like us, is the struggle set forth on a miniature scale in this book. I know, I have seen, the desperation and disorder of the powerless, how it twists the lives of children on the streets of Jakarta or Nairobi in much the same way as it does the lives of children on Chicago's South Side, how narrow the path is for them between humiliation and untrammeled fury, how easily they slip into violence and despair. I know that the response of the powerful to this disorder, alternating as it does between a dull complacency and, when the disorder spills out of its prescribed confines, a steady, unthinking application of force, of longer prison sentences, and more sophisticated military hardware, is inadequate to the task. I know that the hardening of lines, the embrace of fundamentalism and tribe, dooms us all. And so, what was more an interior, intimate effort on my part, to understand this struggle and to find my place in it, has converged with a broader public debate, a debate in which I am professionally engaged, one that will shape our lives and the lives of our children for many years to come. The policy implications of all this are a topic for another book. Let me end this preface instead on a more personal note. Most of the characters in this book remain a part of my life, albeit in varying degrees, a function of work, children, geography, and turns of fate. The exception is my mother, whom we lost with a brutal swiftness to cancer a few months after this book was originally published. She had spent the previous 10 years doing what she loved. She traveled the world, working in the distant villages of Asia and Africa, helping women buy a sewing machine or a milk cow or an education that might give them a foothold in the world's economy. She gathered friends from high and low, took long walks, stared at the moon, and foraged through the local markets of Delhi or Marrakesh for some trifle, a scarf or a stone carving that would make her laugh or please the eye. She wrote reports, read novels, pestered her children, and dreamed of grandchildren. We saw each other frequently, our bond unbroken. During the writing of this book, she would read the drafts, correcting stories that I had misunderstood, careful not to comment on my characterizations of her, but quick to explain or defend the less flattering aspects of my father's character. She managed her illness with grace and good humor, and she helped my sister and me push on with our lives, despite our dread, our denials, our sudden constrictions of the heart. I think sometimes that had I known she would not survive her illness, I might have written a different book, less a meditation on the absent parent, more a celebration of the one who was the single constant in my life. In my daughters, I see her every day, her joy, her capacity for wonder. I won't try to describe how deeply I mourn her passing still. I know that she was the kindest, most generous spirit I have ever known, and that what is best in me, I owe to her. Dreams from My Father, A Story of Race and Inheritance. A few months after my 21st birthday, a stranger called to give me the news. I was living in New York at the time, on 94th between 2nd and 1st, part of that unnamed shifting border between East Harlem and the rest of Manhattan. The line was thick with static. "Betty, Betty, is this you?" "Yes, who's this?" "Yes, Betty, this is your Aunt Jane, in Nairobi. Can you hear me?" "I'm sorry, who'd you say you were?" "Aunt Jane, listen, Barry, your father is dead. He's killed in a car accident. Hello, can you hear me? I say your father is dead. Barry, please call your uncle in Boston and tell him. I can't talk now, okay, Barry? I will call you again." That was all. At the time of his death, my father remained a myth to me, both more and less than a man. He had left Hawaii back in 1963, when I was just 2, so that as a child I knew him only through the stories that my mother and grandparents told. I can still picture Gramps leaning back in his old stuffed chair after dinner, sipping whiskey and cleaning his teeth with the cellophane from his cigarette pack, recounting the time that my father almost threw a man off the Pali lookout because of a pipe. "See, your mom and dad decided to take this friend of his sightseeing around the island," my grandfather begins. "So they drove up to the lookout, and Barack was probably on the wrong side of the road the whole way over there. Your father was a terrible driver," my mother explains to me. "He'd end up on the left-hand side, the way the British drive, and if you said something, he'd just huff about silly American rules. Well, my grandfather continues, this particular time, they arrived in one piece, and they got out and stood out at the railing to admire the view. And Barack, he was puffing away on this pipe that I'd given him for his birthday, pointing out all the sights with the stem, like a sea captain. Your father was really proud of this pipe, my mother interrupts again. He'd smoke it all night while he studied, and sometimes, look, Ann, do you want to tell the story or are you going to let me finish? Sorry, Dad. Go ahead. Anyway, this poor fella, he was another African student, wasn't he? Fresh off the boat. This poor kid must have been impressed with the way Barack was holding forth with this pipe, because he asked if he could give it a try. Your dad thought about it for a minute, and finally agreed. And as soon as the fella took his first puff, he started coughing up a fit. Coughed so hard that the pipe slipped out of his hand and dropped over the railing, 100 feet down the face of the cliff. Gramps stops to take another nip from his flask before continuing. Well now, your dad was gracious enough to wait until his friend stopped coughing before he told him to climb over the railing and bring the pipe back. The man took one peek down this 90-degree incline and told Barack that he'd buy him a replacement. Quite sensibly, Toot says from the kitchen. We call my grandmother Tutu, Toot for short. It means grandparent in Hawaiian, for she decided on the day I was born that she was still too young to be called Granny. Gramps scowls, but decides to ignore her. But Barack was adamant about getting his pipe back, Gramps continues, because it was a gift and couldn't be replaced. So the fella took another look and shook his head again. And that's when your dad picked him clear off the ground and started dangling him off the railing. Gramps lets out a hoot and gives his knee a jovial slap. As he laughs, I imagine myself looking up at my father, dark against the brilliant sun, the transgressor's arms flailing about as he's held aloft, a fearsome vision of justice. He wasn't really holding him over the railing, Dad, my mother says, looking at me with some concern, but Gramps takes another sip of whiskey and plows forward. At this point, other people were starting to stare, and your mother was begging Barack to stop. I guess Barack's friend was just holding his breath and saying his prayers. Anyway, after a couple of minutes, your dad set the man back down on his feet, patted him on the back, and suggested, calm as you please, that they all go find themselves a beer. And don't you know, that's how your dad acted for the rest of the tour, like nothing happened. Of course, your mother was still pretty upset when they got home. Fact, she was barely talking to your dad. Barack wasn't helping matters any either, because when your mother tried to tell us what had happened, he just shook his head and started to laugh. Relax, Anna, he said to her. Your dad had this deep baritone, see, and this British accent. My grandfather tucks his chin into his neck at this point to capture the full effect. Relax, Anna, he said. I only wanted to teach the chop a lesson about the proper care of other people's property. Gramps would start to laugh again until he started to cough, and Toot would mutter under her breath that she supposed it was a good thing that my father had realized that dropping the pipe had just been an accident, because who knows what might have happened otherwise, and my mother would roll her eyes at me and say they were exaggerating. Your father can be a bit domineering, my mother would admit with a hint of a smile, but it's just that he's basically a very honest person. That makes him uncompromising sometimes. My mother preferred a gentler portrait of my father. She would tell the story of when he arrived to accept his Phi Beta Kappa key in his favorite outfit, jeans and an old knit shirt with a leopard print pattern. Nobody told him it was this big honor, she explained, so he walked in and found everyone standing around this elegant room dressed in tuxedos. It's the only time I ever saw him embarrassed. And Gramps, suddenly thoughtful, would start nodding to himself. It's a fact, Bear, he would say. Your dad could handle just about any situation that made everybody like him. Remember the time he had to sing at that international music festival? He agreed to sing some African songs, but when he arrived, it turned out to be this big to-do. And the woman who performed just before him was a semi-professional singer, a Hawaiian gal, with a full band to back her up. Anyone else would have stopped right there, you know, and explained that there had been some mistake. But not Barack. He got up and started singing in front of this big crowd, which is no easy feat, let me tell you. And he wasn't great, but he was so sure of himself that before you knew it, he was getting as much applause as anybody. My grandfather would shake his head and get out of his chair to flip on the TV set. Now there's something you can learn from your dad, he would tell me. Confidence, the secret to a man's success. That's how all the stories went. Compact, apocryphal, told in rapid succession in the course of one evening, then packed away for months, sometimes years, in my family's memory. Like the few photographs of my father that remained in the house. Old black-and-white studio prints that I might run across while rummaging through the closets in search of Christmas ornaments or an old snorkel set. At the point where my own memories begin, my mother had already begun a courtship with the man who would become her second husband, and I sensed, without explanation, why the photographs had to be stored away. The path of my father's life occupied the same terrain as a book my mother once bought for me, a book called Origins, a collection of creation tales from around the world, stories of Genesis and the tree where man was born, Prometheus and the gift of fire, the tortoise of Hindu legend that floated in space, supporting the weight of the world on its back. Later, when I became more familiar with the narrower path of happiness to be found in television and the movies, I became troubled by questions. What supported the tortoise? Why did an omnipotent God let a snake cause such grief? Why didn't my father return? But at the age of 5 or 6, I was satisfied to leave these distant mysteries intact, each story self-contained and as true as the next, to be carried off into peaceful dreams. That my father looked nothing like the people around me, that he was black as pitch, my mother white as milk, barely registered in my mind. In fact, I can recall only one story that dealt explicitly with the subject of race. As I got older, it would be repeated more often, as if it captured the essence of the morality tale that my father's life had become. According to the story, after long hours of study, my father had joined my grandfather and several other friends at a local Waikiki bar. Everyone was in a festive mood, eating and drinking to the sounds of slack-key guitar, when a white man abruptly announced to the bartender, loudly enough for everyone to hear, that he shouldn't have to drink good liquor next to a nigger. The room fell quiet, and people turned to my father expecting a fight. Instead, my father stood up, walked over to the man, smiled, and proceeded to lecture him about the folly of bigotry, the promise of the American dream, and the universal rights of man. "This fella felt so bad when Barack was finished," Gramps would say, "that he reached into his pocket and gave Barack $100 on the spot, paid for all our drinks and poo-poos for the rest of the night, and your dad's rent for the rest of the month." By the time I was a teenager, I'd grown skeptical of this story's veracity and had set it aside with the rest. Until I received a phone call, many years later, from a Japanese-American man who said he had been my father's classmate in Hawaii and now taught at a Midwestern university. He was very gracious, a bit embarrassed by his own impulsiveness. He explained that he had seen an interview of me in his local paper and that the sight of my father's name had brought back a rush of memories. Then, during the course of our conversation, he repeated the same story that my grandfather had told, about the white man who had tried to purchase my father's forgiveness. "I'll never forget that," the man said to me over the phone, and in his voice I heard the same note I'd heard from Gramps so many years before, that note of disbelief and hope. Miscegenation. The word is humpbacked, ugly, portending a monstrous outcome. Like Antebellum or Octoroon, it evokes images of another era, a distant world of horse whips and flames, dead magnolias and crumbling porticos. And yet it wasn't until 1967, the year I celebrated my 6th birthday, and Jimi Hendrix performed at Monterey, 3 years after Dr. King received the Nobel Peace Prize, a time when America had already begun to weary of black demands for equality, the problem of discrimination presumably solved, that the Supreme Court of the United States would get around to telling the state of Virginia that its ban on interracial marriages violated the Constitution. In 1960, the year that my parents were married, miscegenation still described a felony in over half the states in the Union. In many parts of the South, my father could have been strung up from a tree for merely looking at my mother the wrong way. In the most sophisticated of northern cities, the hostile stares, the whispers, might have driven a woman in my mother's predicament into a back-alley abortion, or at the very least to a distant convent that could arrange for adoption. Their very image together would have been considered lurid and perverse, a handy retort to the handful of soft-headed liberals who supported a civil rights agenda. "Sure, but would you let your daughter marry one?" The fact that my grandparents had answered yes to this question, no matter how grudgingly, remains an enduring puzzle to me. There was nothing in their background to predict such a response, no New England transcendentalists or wild-eyed socialists in their family tree. True, Kansas had fought on the Union side of the Civil War. Gramps liked to remind me that various strands of the family contained ardent abolitionists. If asked, Toot would turn her head in profile to show off her beaked nose, which, along with a pair of jet-black eyes, was offered as proof of Cherokee blood. But an old sepia-tone photograph on the bookshelf spoke most eloquently of their roots. It showed Toot's grandparents, of Scottish and English stock, standing in front of a ramshackle homestead, unsmiling and dressed in coarse wool, their eyes squinting at the sun-baked, flinty life that stretched out before them. Theirs were the faces of American Gothic, the Wasp bloodline's poorer cousins, and in their eyes one could see the truth that I would have to learn later as facts, that Kansas had entered the Union free only after a violent precursor to the Civil War, the battle in which John Brown's sword tasted first blood, that while one of my great-great-grandfathers, Christopher Columbus Clark, had been a decorated Union soldier, his wife's mother was rumored to have been a second cousin of Jefferson Davis, president of the Confederacy, that although another distant ancestor had indeed been a full-blooded Cherokee, such lineage was a source of considerable shame to Toot's mother, who blanched whenever someone mentioned the subject and hoped to carry the secret to her grave. That was the world in which my grandparents had been raised, the dab-smack, landlocked center of the country, a place where decency and endurance and the pioneer spirit were joined at the hip with conformity and suspicion and the potential for unblinking cruelty. They'd grown up less than 20 miles away from each other, my grandmother in Augusta, my grandfather in El Dorado, towns too small to warrant boldface on a road map, and the childhoods they liked to recall for my benefit portrayed small-town, Depression-era America in all its innocent glory. 4th of July parades and the picture shows on the side of a barn, fireflies in a jar and the taste of vine-ripe tomatoes sweet as apples, dust storms and hail storms and classrooms filled with farm boys who got sewn into their woolen underwear at the beginning of winter and stank like pigs as the months wore on. Even the trauma of bank failures and farm foreclosures seemed romantic when spun through the loom of my grandparents' memories, a time when hardship, the great leveler that had brought people closer together, was shared by all. So you had to listen carefully to recognize the subtle hierarchies and unspoken codes that had policed their early lives, the distinctions of people who don't have a lot and live in the middle of nowhere. It had to do with something called respectability. There were respectable people and not so respectable people, and although you didn't have to be rich to be respectable, you sure had to work harder at it if you weren't. Toot's family was respectable. Her father held a steady job all through the Depression, managing an oil lease for Standard Oil. Her mother had taught normal school before the children were born. The family kept their house spotless and ordered great books through the mail. They read the Bible, but generally shunned the tent revival circuit, preferring a straight-backed form of Methodism that valued reason over passion and temperance over both. My grandfather's station was more troublesome. Nobody was sure why. The grandparents who had raised him and his older brother weren't very well off, but they were decent, God-fearing Baptists, supporting themselves with work in the oil rigs around Wichita. Somehow, though, Gramps had turned out a bit wild. Some of the neighbors pointed out his mother's suicide. It was my grandfather, after all, then only 8 years old, who had found her body. Other, less charitable souls would simply shake their heads. The boy takes after his philandering father, they would opine, the undoubtable cause of the mother's unfortunate demise. Whatever the reason, Gramps' reputation was apparently well-deserved. By the age of 15, he'd been thrown out of high school for punching the principal in the nose. For the next 3 years, he lived off odd jobs, hopping rail cars to Chicago, then California, then back again, dabbling in moonshine, cards, and women. As he liked to tell it, he knew his way around Wichita, where both his and Toot's families had moved by that time, and Toot doesn't contradict him. Certainly Toot's parents believed the stories they heard about the young man and strongly disapproved of the budding courtship. The first time Toot brought Gramps over to the house to meet the family, her father took one look at my grandfather's black, slicked back hair, and his perpetual wise guy grin, and offered his unvarnished assessment. He looks like a wop. My grandmother didn't care. To her, a home economics major, fresh out of high school and tired of respectability, my grandfather must have cut a dashing figure. I sometimes imagine them, in every American town in those years before the war, him in baggy pants and a starched undershirt, brim hat cocked back on his head, offering a cigarette to this smart-talking girl with too much red lipstick and hair dyed blonde and legs nice enough to model hosiery for the local department store. He's telling her about the big cities, the endless highway, his imminent escape from the empty, dust-ridden plains where big plans mean a job as a bank manager and entertainment means an ice cream soda and a Sunday matinee, where fear and lack of imagination choke your dreams so that you already know on the day that you're born just where you'll die and who it is that'll bury you. He won't end up like that, my grandfather insists. He has dreams. He has plans. He will infect my grandmother with a great peripatetic itch, that had brought both their forebears across the Atlantic and half of a continent so many years before. They eloped just in time for the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and my grandfather enlisted. And at this point, the story quickens in my mind, like one of those old movies that show a wall calendar's pages peeled back faster and faster by invisible hands, the headlines of Hitler and Churchill and Roosevelt in Normandy spinning wildly to the drone of bombing attacks, the voice of Edward R. Murrow on the BBC. I watch as my mother is born at an army base where Gramps is stationed. My grandmother is Rosie the Riveter, working on a bomber assembly line. My grandfather sloshes around in the mud of France, part of Patton's army. Gramps returned from the war never having seen real combat, and the family headed to California, where he enrolled at Berkeley under the GI Bill. But the classroom couldn't contain his ambitions, his restlessness, and so the family moved again, first back to Kansas, then through a series of small Texas towns, then finally to Seattle, where they stayed long enough for my mother to finish high school. Gramps worked as a furniture salesman. They bought a house and found themselves bridge partners. They were pleased that my mother proved bright in school, although when she was offered early admission into the University of Chicago, my grandfather forbade her to go, deciding that she was still too young to be living on her own. And that's where the story might have stopped. A home, a family, a respectable life. Except something must have still been gnawing at my grandfather's heart. I can imagine him standing at the edge of the Pacific, his hair prematurely gray, his tall, lanky frame bulkier now, looking out at the horizon until he could see it curve and still smelling, deep in his nostrils, the oil rigs and corn husks and hard-bitten lives that he thought he had left far behind. So that when the manager of the furniture company where he worked happened to mention that a new store was about to open in Honolulu, the business prospects seemed limitless there, what with statehood right around the corner, he would rush home that same day and talk my grandmother into selling their house and packing up yet again to embark on the final leg of their journey, west, towards the setting sun. He would always be like that, my grandfather, always searching for that new start, always running away from the familiar. By the time the family arrived in Hawaii, his character would have been fully formed, I think. The generosity and eagerness to please, the awkward mix of sophistication and provincialism, the rawness of emotion that could make him at once tactless and easily bruised. His was an American character, one typical of men of his generation, men who embraced the notion of freedom and individualism and the open road without always knowing its price, and whose enthusiasms could as easily lead to the cowardice of McCarthyism as to the heroics of World War II. Men who were both dangerous and promising precisely because of their fundamental innocence. Men prone, in the end, to disappointment. In 1960, though, my grandfather had not yet been tested. The disappointments would come later, and even then they would come slowly, without the violence that might have changed him, for better or for worse. In the back of his mind, he had come to consider himself something of a free thinker, bohemian even. He wrote poetry on occasion, listened to jazz, counted a number of Jews he'd met in the furniture business as his closest friends. In his only skirmish into organized religion, he would enroll the family in the local Unitarian Universalist congregation. He liked the idea that Unitarians drew on the scriptures of all the great religions. "It's like you get five religions in one," he would say. Toot would eventually dissuade him of his views on the church. "For Christ's sake, Stanley, religion's not supposed to be like buying breakfast cereal." But if my grandmother was more skeptical by nature, and disagreed with Gramps on some of his more outlandish notions, her stubborn independence, her own insistence on thinking something through for herself, generally brought them into rough alignment. All this marked them as vaguely liberal, although their ideas would never congeal into anything like a firm ideology. In this, too, they were American. And so, when my mother came home one day and mentioned a friend she had met at the University of Hawaii, an African student named Barack, their first impulse was to invite him over for dinner. The poor kid's probably lonely, Gramps would have thought, so far away from home. "Better take a look at him," Toot would have said to herself. When my father arrived at the door, Gramps might have been immediately struck by the African's resemblance to Nat King Cole, one of his favorite singers. I imagine him asking my father if he can sing, not understanding the mortified look on my mother's face. Gramps is probably too busy telling one of his jokes, or arguing with Toot over how to cook the steaks, to notice my mother reach out and squeeze the smooth, sinewy hand beside hers. Toot notices, but she's polite enough to bite her lip and offer dessert. Her instincts warn her against making a scene. When the evening is over, they'll both remark on how intelligent the young man seems, so dignified with the measured gestures, the graceful draping of one leg over another, and how about that accent? But would they let their daughter marry one? We don't know yet. The story to this point doesn't explain enough. The truth is that, like most white Americans at the time, they had never really given black people much thought. Jim Crow had made its way north into Kansas well before my grandparents were born, but at least around Wichita it appeared in its more informal, genteel form, without much of the violence that pervaded the Deep South. The same unspoken codes that governed life among whites kept contact between the races to a minimum. When black people appear at all in the Kansas of my grandparents' memories, the images are fleeting. Black men who come around the oil fields once in a while searching for work as hired hands. Black women taking in the white folks' laundry or helping clean white homes. Blacks are there but not there, like Sam the piano player or Beulah the maid or Amos and Andy on the radio. Shadowy, silent presences that elicit neither passion nor fear. It wasn't until my family moved to Texas, after the war, that questions of race began to intrude on their lives. During his first week on the job there, Gramps received some friendly advice from his fellow furniture salesman about serving black and Mexican customers. If the coloreds want to look at the merchandise, they need to come around after hours and arrange for their own delivery. Later, at the bank where she worked, Toot made the acquaintance of the janitor, a tall and dignified black World War II vet she remembers only as Mr. Reed. While the two of them chatted in the hallway one day, a secretary in the office stormed up and hissed that Toot should never, ever call no nigger mister. Not long afterward, Toot would find Mr. Reed in a corner of the building weeping quietly to himself. When she asked him what was wrong, he straightened his back, dried his eyes, and responded with a question of his own. What have we ever done to be treated so mean? My grandmother didn't have an answer that day, but the question lingered in her mind, one that she and Gramps would sometimes discuss once my mother had gone to bed. They decided that Toot would keep calling Mr. Reed Mr., although she understood, with a mixture of relief and sadness, the careful distance that the janitor now maintained whenever they passed each other in the halls. Gramps began to decline invitations from his co-workers to go out for a beer, telling them he had to go home to keep his wife happy. They grew inward, skittish, filled with a vague apprehension, as if they were permanent strangers in town. This bad new air hit my mother the hardest. She was 11 or 12 by this time, an only child just growing out of a bad case of asthma. The illness, along with the numerous moves, had made her something of a loner, cheerful and easy-tempered, but prone to bury her head in a book or wander off on solitary walks. And Toot began to worry that this latest move had only made her daughter's eccentricities more pronounced. My mother made few friends at her new school. She was teased mercilessly for her name, Stanley Ann, one of Gramps' less judicious ideas. He had wanted a son. Stanley Steamer, they called her. Stan the Man. When Toot got home from work, she would usually find my mother alone in the front yard, swinging her legs off the porch or lying in the grass, pulled into some solitary world of her own. Except for one day. There was that one hot, windless day when Toot came home to find a crowd of children gathered outside the picket fence that surrounded their house. As Toot drew closer, she could make out the sound of mirthless laughter, the contortions of rage and disgust on the children's faces. The children were chanting in a high-pitched, alternating rhythm. "Nigger lover! Dirty Yankee! Nigger lover!" The children scattered when they saw Toot, but not before one of the boys had sent a stone in his hand sailing over the fence. Toot's eyes followed the stone's trajectory as it came to a rest at the foot of a tree. And there she saw the cause for all the excitement. My mother and a black girl of about the same age, lying side by side on their stomachs in the grass, their skirts gathered up above their knees, their toes dug into the ground, their heads propped up on their hands in front of one of my mother's books. From a distance, the two girls seemed perfectly serene beneath the leafy shade. It was only when Toot opened the gate that she realized the black girl was shaking, and my mother's eyes shone with tears. The girls remained motionless, paralyzed in their fear, until Toot finally leaned down and put her hand on both of their heads. "If you two are going to play," she said, "then for goodness sake, go inside. Come on, both of you." She picked up my mother and reached for the other girl's hand, but before she could say anything, the girl was in a full sprint, her long legs like a whippet's, as she vanished down the street. Gramps was beside himself when he heard what had happened. He interrogated my mother, wrote down names. The next day he took the morning off from work to visit the school principal. He personally called the parents of some of the offending children to give them a piece of his mind. And from every adult that he spoke to, he received the same response. "You best talk to your daughter, Mr. Dunham. White girls don't play with coloreds in this town."
Wow. Wow. Woo! Context of white supremacy. I can only tell you, I thoroughly enjoyed reading this book. I think I said that when I, you know, was telling folks that we were going to do the audiobook on Dreams from My Father. I said that I, when I read this book, 2008, I didn't want to read it. The only reason I read it was that there was a black female who was less confused, who I started, I just met her while we were doing the radio program, and we used to talk about racism all the time. She's a grad student in architecture. And, whoo, buddy, 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 so many stories. Cowbell would be ringing and everything. Anyway, we started talking about racism, white supremacy, and she was a big Obama fan, and I think like a lot of black people just thought, you know, he's the best thing ever, and I'm so excited, and you got to read his book, and blah, blah, blah. And so we traded, right? This is how come I don't have a code book, is because I gave my copy to her to read Dreams from My Father. And, you know, I really was not looking forward to it. It's just, I was not, I have the same opinion about President Obama I had at the time, 2008. I had the same opinion then that I have now, that he is a victim of racism. We are under a system of white supremacy. He is not white. He's not in charge. Same opinion. So, you know, I really didn't want to read it, but once I did, oh man, I could not put it down. I was just like, this is fascinating. Wow, so many things stood out. I took notes. Man, oh man. I'll give out the number in case folks want to dial in. This book club, so we're supposed to be sharing. This is not just listening to Gus ramble. The number is 760-569-7676. And the code is 564-943-POUND. Press *6. If you have questions, thoughts, comments, definitely looking forward to hearing thoughts. Just the first 35 minutes. Wow. Wow. Definitions. I will, before I even get to anything that I thought about what was said, definitions. I think I've said that before. One of the things we can do that will help boost our skill with words and language, definitions. When you read a book, you hit a word, you don't know what it means, you look it up. I looked up three terms just in that first 35 minutes. I looked up three terms. The three terms that I looked up. Number one, WOP, W-O-P, WOP, noun. He was saying that his, he was saying that when his, I guess that would be his grandfather, when his grandfather and his grandmother were first meeting one another, when his grandmother's father saw his grandfather, he said, oh, looks like a WOP. A WOP means, according to the dictionary definition I got, a contemptuous term for an Italian or other Southern European. Now, I've heard this term used before, and to me, I would say that this, they got this, informal. Informal, offensive. Offensive, excuse me, that's what I meant to emphasize. They have this as a slur. I think this is a racist term. This is a term that white people fight amongst themselves about who is the supreme white person. And they'll say that some white people are less powerful or maybe even on the borders, the low end of being a white person. I've heard a lot of disputes about this. We've even done some programs on this. Go back in the archives. But that was one, WOP. The next one was pitch. He said that his mother was white as milk and his father, black male, was dark or black as pitch. Pitch, the second definition that I got, there are a lot of definitions for pitch, baseball pitch, Dr. Welsing. But the second noun definition for pitch that I think they were using here, pitch, a sticky, resinous, black, or dark brown substance that is semi-liquid when hot, hard when cold. It is obtained by distilling tar or petroleum oil and is used for waterproofing. Any of various similar substances such as asphalt or bitumen. A sticky resinous sap from a conifer. That is pitch. And the last term that I looked up was peripatetic. Peripatetic. Adjective, traveling from place to place, especially working or based in various places for relatively short periods. Also, they have Aristotelian, relating to Aristotle, reference to Aristotle's practice of walking to and fro while teaching. Those are two definitions for peripatetic. They were talking about her, his quote-unquote WAP grandfather and the peripatetic lifestyle that they would have. So those are three terms that I looked up. I thought that that helped reveal some information, getting more about the subtext and what is being communicated. All right, keep it in mind, like I said, I'm looking for things. What messages are being conveyed to white people? What messages are being conveyed to white people, and then anything else that stands out. Person that dialed in from a block number, your line is open. Actually, let me give out the number one more time. 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you have questions, comments, want to participate, star 6. Person at block number, your line is open.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, what I gathered from the reading was he portrayed his grandfather as someone of John Brown, somewhat of a John Brown character, how he was so upset, you know, that the black girl that was playing with his daughter got mistreated, and he went to the school and gave them a piece of his mind, and how he was, you know, liberal in the sense that he allowed Barack's father to come in the house and, you know, tell jokes and stories or whatnot, and that, you know, he just, the way he portrayed his grandfather, I didn't even know that, because this is my first time listening and hearing, not hearing about the book, but this is my first time listening to it. So there's a lot of things I didn't know about Barack after listening to this session. So yeah, that's one of the things I came across. That I got from the book. That's all I have for now. If I have some more thoughts, I will unmute my line and state my comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Definitely appreciate that. That is huge. Absolutely. John Brown. Excellent. And they even said, they mentioned John Brown. They said that's right. Yeah, burning Kansas. That is a big one in the John Brown mythology, fighting over whether there was going to be slavery in Kansas. And that's before they did the whole get down at Harper's Ferry down the road. But yeah, he gets brought up explicitly. And I think they said, or President Obama, he mentions in the story, in the book, that his family, his grandfather used to brag that they had abolitionist roots, whatever that means. Some white people who were alleging to be against slavery, ostensibly racism, white supremacy. Yeah, that is incredible. And continuing that legacy, we let our daughter play with the black children, and you know, stood up to these other white people that he knew. I thought that was interesting, too. We're not talking about strangers. He knew who these people were, these young terrorist racist children who were out yelling nigger lover. He knew who they were. He knew their parents probably went to church with them, school with them, on the bank board with them. Like these, this is their pals. And I love the respect. Oh, I'm so enjoying this. I'm so enjoying this. That's why I said I think people, whatever your view is, I'm not playing this for people to go out and vote for President Obama. I'm not playing it. I'm not playing doing this for people to go out and scrutinize him and say, oh, I got more information that this guy is no good and he's devious or what have you. I just think it's interesting. I think it reveals a lot about racism, white supremacy. You can learn a lot. We can refine our skill with language and we can look at what messages are being communicated to white people. And I think just that right there is huge. What it's saying about his quote unquote liberal abolitionist, not racist white grandparents. I think that is huge. And I think that is one that's huge for the message it sends to white people and to non-white people. Like, oh, see there? There are some not racist white people and his parents. See there? And this further cements that false idea, that notion that somehow having sex with white people helps fight against racism. It puts that in your mind. See that? There are some white people who would be okay with it. There are some white parents who would be okay if their son or daughter married and had children with a non-white person, right? It puts that idea, it plants that seed to make you think this is somehow going to erode racism. The person that called in 3921, your line is open as well. 3921, think this might, is this Shadow?
No, this is Prav.
Prav, dang.
Yeah, I noticed two things. One was that in the very beginning when he's reading it, he says that his mother helped him to edit certain things and change certain things to make it sort of more accurate. So that's kind of, I'm suspicious about, you know, that, and I wonder what was changed. And the second thing was I noticed, I don't know if this was the father or the grandfather, how pleased he was when Barack's father held this man over a railing. It's like he was, you know, it's like a, you know, something that made him very happy, almost like he was watching gladiators go at it.
I wrote that down as well. Both of those, I think, are extremely important. I wrote that down as well. The pride, even if it's exaggerated. But a black male assaulting another black male over a gift from a white person. Oh, and Dr. Welsing, the symbolic penis, the pipe, Dr. Welsing moment. Yeah, I thought that was real important. That's one of the few stories that they would put out and tell and recant. And that's one of the first stories, one of the first anecdotes that you get in the book. And then about his mom being the editor. Just that whole sequence at the beginning, I thought was, I thought it was really important. It's giving voice, it's recognizing the mother, her influence, her authority, really. I mean, being editor and going over, that's a big deal for a best-selling book, future president. You get to edit his memoir. I mean, wow. Major influence of the white woman. And then the fact that he explicitly states that she was not editing to make sure that she came out looking good or to control what he had to say, but just for accuracy. And then she would verbally defend, you know, certain, she wasn't even defending herself. I thought that was important too. It was, she would defend certain characterizations of his father. She wasn't even defending how he portrayed her. She just spoke up to defend the black male. I thought that was, wow. I mean, just real significant portion. Excellent. Both of those are really great points, I think. One more person I'm adding to the line, so all three lines will be open. Skype caller. Skype caller, your line should be open as well.
Hey, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, this is a very interesting piece right here, this book. I think this book is is very good at contributing the notion of progress. I think you mentioned something similar just now. It's like, you know, by having this mixed guy, you know, come out with this book and he's achieved all these accomplishments and, you know, eventually use this book as a tool to become president. It just kind of, you know, is like the apex of, you know, that notion of that, you know, things are getting better, which I think is, you know, goes against, you know, countering the system. So I that's one point that I want to highlight.
I got another point I'd like to make, if I may.
Oh, go ahead. That term mixed hurt my ears. Still want to try to be as codified as we can. That term mixed, I try not to use that, but go ahead.
Yes, sir. I'm not sure I buy the story about when the father was in the bar and that white man said, I shouldn't have to enjoy a good beer with a nigger or something like that. I'm not sure I quite buy that the white man gave him $100. I don't know. I don't quite buy that. I think they kind of like stretched it a little bit to make him, you know, to make Obama feel, you know, important and not feel, you know, worthless, you know, when he was a young boy or whatnot. You know, even he didn't believe it himself when he heard it, you know. So even though he kind of recanted on it and said, well, there was this other guy who was, you know, happened to go to the same school as his father, he kind of made him believe in that story. But I personally, I don't buy it. I call BS on it.
I definitely think, I believe that it's possible that a white person could have done that. Now, the whole response, him, I think it said he paid his rent for a month and he got real. This white person, feeling very guilty and wanting to compensate for the practice of racism, bought him some drinks, gave him some money and paid his rent and all that other stuff. I don't know about that, but I definitely believe it's possible that a white person could announce that they don't think they should have to drink good beer next to a nigger. I definitely think that's possible. And yeah, I'll leave it there.
No, I think you misunderstood me. I believe that part. I just don't believe the guy gave him $100.
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir. That's what I understood you to be saying. Yeah.
Hey, if he got $100, I want to know what he said, because I could use those words. No situation.
Hey, man. Get paid for being called a nigger. We all need that. We need explicit details on that.
Yeah, man. This, you know, how he was suspicious about, you know, the veracity, as they said, of that story. I've read one half of this book because I used to own it, but as I started reading the book, I called into question the veracity of this book. I was like, man, this book was painting Obama as some kind of revolutionary, and I was like, wait a minute, this guy is a candidate for presidency. But we haven't gotten there yet, so I'll just leave that one for later.
Now I read the whole thing. I didn't come away from the book thinking of him as a revolutionary. I do remember being surprised. Now that will be interesting. This needs to be highlighted. He uses the term white supremacy in this book. I remember being stunned when I got to that part of the book. Now I'm real sure they did not put that in the audiobook, so I'll have to find that in the text and see where they edit that out. But even with that, I didn't, even when I got to the end, I didn't think of him from the book. I didn't think of him as a quote unquote revolutionary. I guess it depends. What do you mean when you say revolutionary?
I was exaggerating a little bit. It was like when he was organizing in Chicago, and then he talking about how he used to blast music loud to upset European people. You know, it made it seem like he was some sort of, like, you know, someone opposed to the status quo. And it just, like, you know, it's just contrary to the image that he has today. I guess that's more accurate. You know, I was exaggerating in the revolutionary picture, but still, you know, if you look at it as a, you know, what side you're leaning toward, he was still, you know, on the anti-white supremacy side, which, you know, I don't know about all that. It just, it just seemed like a big hoax to me.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I can see, you know, now as I'm reading the book, why he would appeal to whites. You asked that question. I think it's because his Asili, I mean, it's almost like he understands the European Asili, like from the book Yorugu. So he knows how to speak about universalism. And he speaks about justice. But it's kind of like, it's almost like he speaks about it, but the wheels aren't there to actually get there. Like, he had a car, there's no wheels. So his solution for getting there is for us to sort of submit to it or say everything's okay, the past is forgiven. So there doesn't seem to be a clear way to get to justice, but he speaks about justice, and he sort of offers them a... almost like a blank check. Like, oh, that's the past, and there were a lot of bad things that occurred. We just need to move on, you know, and accept each other. But it seems like that's not really a rational or a feasible response, because it's constantly going.
Excellent point, caller. There was another thing that stood out to me as well when this one was in the beginning when he got the phone call. He got a phone call from a relative saying, Barry, your father died. He didn't explain how he got the name Barry, that out. I don't know if they go into detail about it. And, you know, throughout through the ending of the book, I don't know, but I noticed that he didn't, you know, explain the you know, his name being, him being called Barry and all of that. I mean, I've heard some Republicans, extreme conservatives, you know, taunt him by calling him Barry, but... he didn't explain that. I don't know if he does, like, as we continue on, but I noticed that he didn't explain that. It was like a quick, you know, he just made a quick mention of it, but without explaining it, you know.
I think that does get... I think that, I don't know if they go into detail on it in the audiobook, but in the text... they do, I think, give some background on his name and what people have called him in his time on the planet. I do recall them going into that detail in the book.
To the caller that referenced the Asili, I would have to agree with you on that. When I was listening to it, and I noticed those buzzwords of universalism and progress, and, you know, how they view time, and you're right on, spot on, that, you know, it definitely appeals to that, you know, that racist Asili.
Yeah, you know, and when I compare and contrast, I mean, if you compare and contrast Neely Fuller's work with what he talks about, and then also the Yorugu's concept of universalism, I mean, it's all talking about same thing, justice. But I mean, Neely Fuller, for example, says, here's what you do, here's what you say, here's how you behave to bring about justice. Now, the European Asili seems to say, this is how you talk, this is how you convince others that you believe in this. But at the same time, this is just to make you feel better about your practice of racism, white supremacy. So it's almost like talking with the same outcome, but one is actually practical, where you're actually doing things to solve the problem, and the other is just sort of paying lip service to it. And it appears that he's definitely well versed in that universalism, the European version.
think to piggyback on that, like to compare Mr. Fuller's work and what he wrote, comparing that with President Obama and what he wrote, in my opinion, you would look at the purpose for the books, and I think Mr. Fuller is very explicit. The purpose for him writing his book, Victims of Racism, Replace the System of Racism, White Supremacy with Justice. I could be wrong, but I don't think that is the purpose for writing Dreams from My Father. Excuse me. I don't think that was the purpose for that book being written. In fact, that might be something to ponder on. What is the purpose of this book? And I think getting at that question, you would kind of have to think, who is the target audience for this book? And I just have to assume it's white people. I have to assume that. And I'm looking at this book as a part of a exercise in racial showcasing. And if that's what it is, then I would have to be looking at this as a part of a greater racist project. So I would be thinking, okay, there are going to be some white people who will be involved in this whole book process, getting the book out, helping him. He's already said that, that from the very beginning. His white mother was right there editing the volume. I'm sure there were some other white people who were intimately involved in the process of putting this package together. And I think white people are very scared. If we go with Yorugu, I think white people, one of the most important terms that I got from that book, the rhetorical ethic. I think white people are very skilled at making it sound like they might be about practicing justice when they actually are not. White people are very good at that, and I think they know how to articulate. They know how to code a message so that white people will get that rhetorical ethic, and they will also get the message, particularly if it's a non-white person talking, that I'm really not about replacing white supremacy with justice. This is a part of our package, so that white people get that message. And I think some of the things that you all have mentioned, I think white people would immediately get that. I think, in fact, I think white people would see the white fingerprints on this. They would know. We don't even have to worry about this. This is a part of our package. We got it. We understand. We see our fingerprints on this. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, absolutely. When you mentioned rhetorical ethic, it reminded me of when Marimba Ani used the word exports. She said, you know, all of this stuff is largely for export to other cultures. And I think I just love that analogy to economics, that, you know, we have no intention of consuming this ourselves. We have no intention of consuming justice. This is for export to all everyone else on the planet.
I think that you could argue that this would probably please white people and then confuse non-white people.
Say that one more time, please.
This book would please white people in terms of making them feel comfortable, but it would confuse non-white people to think that we live in a universalist society.
Democracy. Beautiful analysis. In my opinion, I could be incorrect. I would just add on to that. I think that you are equally confused. If you read this, or even if you don't read this, and you somehow come to the conclusion that the problem is President Obama, I would say you are equally confused. And I would say the people, they read it and end up being angry and investing a lot of time and energy focused on President Obama being the person to blame for this. I would say they got you there too. They have been equally successful, in my view, and I could be wrong about that.
I got a question for one of the callers. He kind of mentioned that when he first read the book, I don't know who it was, but kind of mentioned that, you know, the whole Obama story is sort of like a hoax. I wanted to know, like, what he meant by that, because I think he hinted on the fact that, you know, he was running for president. But I think in the book, Obama did say that when the book first came out, it didn't sell, you know, and it only started to sell when he started to run for his Senate seat or whatever back in 06 or 07, I'm not sure. And then when he started to run for president, I guess the book really became a bestseller. But I wanted to know what the caller meant by when he said it was sort of like a hoax, like his story was sort of like fake or whatever.
Okay, that was me.
When I
said hoax, it seemed like it was too good at setting the stage. That's what I mean. You know, like this was planned out, you know, 20 years ago.
The book came out in 96. Nobody knew who he was. I mean, how can you say that, you know?
This book didn't come out in 96.
It wasn't selling.
This book didn't come out in 1996.
When did it come out?
2005.
But didn't he say that he was, didn't Barack said that he was, you know, the idea of the book came about, like, after he, when he became president of his law review or whatever?
The idea for the book may have come about
I understood him. I thought that the book came out in 96 or 97.
Can I interject
that,
really
that
quick?
That was like a revision, a new updated version of it. I'm sorry, I got that all wrong.
I'm looking at it on Wikipedia. It says the original publication date is 1995.
Part in 95.
That's why I you know, that actually adds to why I suspected of being some kind of trickery, because it seemed like it was planned well in advance. And that's what I mean.
I don't know. I'm not sure I buy into that whole, you know, Manchurian candidate type of thing. You know what I'm saying? I don't know. I'm not saying that it's not possible, but I mean, what's the evidence? You know what I'm saying? It's, you know, like the book didn't sell well, according to Barack. It didn't sell very well, and nobody knew who he was. Books really started to sell like when he was running for his Senate seat, I believe, back in 05 or 06. And then as soon as he was running for president, the book reached critical mass, and then boom, you know, it got on the bestseller list. I mean, to say that, you know, it was planned in advance, I don't know. I'm not sure I buy that.
Okay, well, I did not allude to any Manchurian candidate, you know, type mythology, but that you asked me that what I meant. That's what I meant. So,
okay, I got you.
And I would just add that, you know, sales of books do not necessarily correlate to overall impact. I mean, Yorugu hasn't sold that many copies, but I'm sure has a huge impact.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir, go ahead.
Okay. I mean, I'll speak for myself. I mean, I was raised with the universalist principle, and, you know, I didn't even know I was being sold something that was no good. You know, I was raised to, you know, it's like some of the things that he talks about. I mean, this is what, you know, I grew up, my father is a non-white black male. I mean, this is how I was raised, that if you work hard and you don't let anything stop you, then, you know, and you show these people that, hey, you can be smarter, you can study harder, then that's how you defeat racism. So, I mean, I totally can understand his viewpoint. And I think a lot of non-whites, we're confused by that. I mean, we like the idea of universalism, but it's sort of like the way we get to justice is by submitting to white supremacy. That's what, I mean, if you just break it down, that's what it is. You win by submitting to it. I think that's what book sort of, I think that's a big theme of it. It'd be, you know, at least from, you know, I was halfway through the book.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think it's always easy to get people to believe a lie that they want to believe.
I think that's a big part of our confusion is that, you know, this is the stuff we were raised on. And that's, you know, I had a colleague tell me that they read Dreams from My Father when they were more confused. And then they said as they became less confused, when they read it now, they get so much more out of it because now they can sort of see behind the rhetoric and understand really what's going on. And I would agree with him in that, you know, in the second reading, you know, I'm seeing things I didn't even see the first time.
Here, here. I'm in the same group. When I read, actually, number one, thank you for correcting Gus, the publication of the book, being 1996. I was confused. I looked at the wrong publication date, had the 2005 on it. I did make the correction in the description for the program and the other places where I put it down to make sure that it reflects the book's publication to be 1996. My bad. I am a victim. Do make errors. Thank you for the correction. But I would say that's important, too, though, in terms of talking about the packaging. If this is a project in racial showcasing, I think it works much better, this book being published in 1996 and not being that popular. I think it looks a lot more authentic as opposed to it coming out 2005. That's really close to the election, in my opinion. I think it looks a lot more believable. But hey, yeah, 1996, he wrote this book, at Harvard, whatever, it comes out, it's okay, no big deal. And then later on, when he's running for president, oh yeah, just happen to have my little autobiography right here, tells my little story of my growing up and Twit and Gramps and the whole nine. I think it works really well that way. Anyway, to the latter point about folks, non-white people reading this book being less confused, man, the first time I read it, I was less confused. I'd already read Mr. Fuller's work, and I talked to him. But now having 4 years to build on that, it's very enjoyable. As I said, not as an endorsement of President Obama, not trying to attack him, just trying to better understand racism, white supremacy. I think there's a lot that you can learn from this text. And we just got started, so there should be a lot.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. You know, this is a very short beginning segment of the book. I read half of this before, but I don't remember much of any of this stuff. It's kind of interesting why I didn't remember this. And I guess another thing that I noticed during this segment particular right here is seem to be a lot of highlighting of the struggles that his white family endured at the hands of other white people. You know, it was kind of like, you know, they were still, the problem was still white people.
Yeah, I peeped that too. Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't get the sense that his father being a black male at that time. I didn't get a sense of some of his struggles, you know. But then again, you know, we get in the story from what his grandparents and his mother told him. I don't think he had any type of relationship with his pops. I could be wrong, but like I said, this is like my first time hearing the story, so I don't know if toward the end that, you know, he talks more about his relationship with his father, but that's what I was able to gather.
We'll do like five more minutes. And then we'll play the second segment. If anybody else wants to chime in, any of the folks that are on the line, if you got anything you want to get in, like another 5 minutes. I took note. I thought it was significant. It goes in line with what you all have already touched on. When Tit, his grandmother, white grandmother, when she points out her nose and talks about being having Cherokee in her family, it reminded me of Elizabeth Warren, a white woman who did that recently to get in school, alleging that she had Native American ancestry. Also talking about his grandfather being a World War II veteran and the Patton reference. I played sound clips of Patton before. I think that's real important, communicating a message to white people. That's so Mr. Fuller. I've heard Mr. Fuller talk about the Greatest Generation and Patton in the 50s and World War II. That's sending a huge message to white people, in my opinion, so that you get the fingerprints of white people are on this. This is us. I think that's a huge message right there. And I think that's consistent because I heard similar references. The World War II veteran talking about his grandmother. Oh, my gosh, his grandmother. Every time he's been coming out talking, they got to reference grandma. Got to reference grandma. Even Michelle Obama got to reference the white grandmother. Also, oh, man, huge moment. Big message. What? Please, white people, confuse non-white people. The sentence where he's talking about white people, they had never given black people much thought. Oh, man, I almost stopped the audio. Nothing could be further from the truth. Nothing could be further from the truth. Now, that's one you have to think about that. Did President Obama, if he wrote this, does he know that is not true? Because I think a lot of black people are confused about that. A lot of black people would believe that. I would say if you understand racism, white supremacy, nothing could be further from the truth. There is nothing white people think about more than mistreating black and non-white people. Nothing. Real important point.
One last point I'd like to make is before the 5 minutes is up, I think before the first chapter began, I think Barack Obama was talking about how he would have changed some of the stuff that he wrote about in the book. Looking back at it, I'm curious as to what it is that he, you know, wanted to change. Could it be that the term white supremacy might have taken that out, or some of the language about, you know, that his grandparents, maybe not his grandparents, but some of the white people that he came in contact with used around black people. Because he said that he has a whole different, you know, worldview than he did back then. So he said he would have changed, he would have made some changes. I'm just curious as to what it is he might have want to change. But then again, as I listen more and more, you know, probably filling those gaps.
Anything else? All righty. If you didn't get to share, you have something you want to get in, just jot it down. We'll do the next segment, and then we'll share on the other side. This one, too, is a little over 30 minutes. Dreams from My Father, President Barack Obama, published 1996. Thank you for the correction. 1996. Part 2, Dreams from My Father.
It's hard to know how much weight to give these episodes, what permanent allegiances were made or broken, or whether they stand out only in the light of subsequent events. Whenever he spoke to me about it, Gramps would insist that the family left Texas in part because of their discomfort with such racism. Toot would be more circumspect. Once, when we were alone, she told me that they had moved from Texas only because Gramps wasn't doing particularly well on his job, and because a friend in Seattle had promised them something better. According to her, the word racism wasn't even in their vocabulary back then. Your grandfather and I just figured we should treat people decently, Bear. That's all. She's wise that way, my grandmother, suspicious of overwrought sentiment or overblown claims, content with common sense. Which is why I tend to trust her account of events. It corresponds to what I know about my grandfather, his tendency to rewrite his history to conform with the image he wished for himself. And yet, I don't entirely dismiss Gramps' recollection of events as a convenient bit of puffery, another act of white revisionism. I can't, precisely because I know how strongly Gramps believed in his fictions, how badly he wanted them to be true, even if he didn't always know how to make them so. After Texas, I suspect that black people became a part of these fictions of his, the narrative that worked its way through his dreams. The condition of the black race, their pain, their wounds, would in his mind become merged with his own. The absent father and the hint of scandal, the mother who had gone away, the cruelty of other children, the realization that he was no fair-haired boy, that he looked like a wop. Racism was part of that past, his instincts told him. Part of convention and respectability and status, the smirks and whispers and gossip that had kept him on the outside looking in. Those instincts count for something, I think. For many white people of my grandfather's generation and background, the instincts ran in an opposite direction, the direction of the mob. And although Gramps' relationship with my mother was already strained by the time they reached Hawaii, she would never quite forgive his instability and often violent temper, and would grow ashamed of his crude, ham-fisted manners. It was this desire of his to obliterate the past, this confidence in the possibility of remaking the world from whole cloth, that proved to be his most lasting patrimony. Whether Gramps realized it or not, the sight of his daughter, with a black man, offered at some deep, unexplored level, a window into his own heart. Not that such self-knowledge, even if accessible, would have made my mother's engagement any easier for him to swallow. In fact, how and when the marriage occurred remains a bit murky, a bill of particulars that I've never quite had the courage to explore. There's no record of a real wedding, a cake, a ring, a giving away of the bride. No families were in attendance. It's not even clear that people back in Kansas were fully informed. Just a small civil ceremony, a justice of the peace. The whole thing seems so fragile in retrospect, so haphazard. And perhaps that's how my grandparents intended it to be, a trial that would pass, just a matter of time, so long as they maintained a stiff upper lip and didn't do anything drastic. If so, they miscalculated, not only my mother's quiet determination, but also the sway of their own emotions. First, the baby arrived, 8 pounds, 2 ounces, with 10 toes and 10 fingers, and hungry for food. What in the heck were they supposed to do? Then time and place began to conspire, transforming potential misfortune into something tolerable, even a source of pride. Sharing a few beers with my father, Gramps might listen to his new son-in-law sound off about politics or the economy, about far-off places like Whitehall or the Kremlin, and imagine himself seeing into the future. He would begin to read the newspapers more carefully, finding early reports of America's newfound integrationist creed, and decide in his mind that the world was shrinking, sympathies changing, that the family from Wichita had in fact moved to the forefront of Kennedy's new frontier and Dr. King's magnificent dream. How could America send men into space and still keep its black citizens in bondage? One of my earliest memories is of sitting on my grandfather's shoulders as the astronauts from one of the Apollo missions arrived at Hickam Air Force Base after a successful splashdown. I remember the astronauts in aviator glasses as being far away, barely visible through the portal of an isolation chamber. But Gramps would always swear that one of the astronauts waved just at me and that I waved back. It was part of the story he told himself. With his black son-in-law and his brown grandson, Gramps had entered the space age. And what better port for setting off on this new adventure than Hawaii, the Union's newest member? Even now, with the state's population quadrupled, with Waikiki jammed wall-to-wall with fast food emporiums and pornographic video stores, and subdivisions marching relentlessly into every fold of Green Hill, I can retrace the first steps I took as a child and be stunned by the beauty of the islands. The trembling blue plain of the Pacific, the moss-covered cliffs, and cool rush of Manoa Falls, with its ginger blossoms and high canopies filled with the sound of invisible birds. The North Shore's thunderous waves, crumbling as if in a slow-motion reel. The shadows off Polly's Peaks. The sultry, scented air. There was only one problem. My father was missing, and nothing that my mother or grandparents could tell me could obviate that single unassailable fact. Their stories didn't tell me why he had left. They couldn't describe what it might have been like had he stayed. Like the janitor, Mr. Reed, or the black girl who churned up dust as she raced down a Texas road, my father became a prop in someone else's narrative. An attractive prop, the alien figure with the heart of gold, the mysterious stranger who saves the town and wins the girl, but a prop nonetheless. I don't really blame my mother or grandparents for this. My father may have preferred the image they created for him. Indeed, he may have been complicit in his creation. In an article published in the Honolulu Star Bulletin upon his graduation, he appears guarded and responsible, the model student, ambassador for his continent. He mildly scolds the university for herding visiting students into dormitories and forcing them to attend programs designed to promote cultural understanding, a distraction, he says, from the practical training he seeks. Although he hasn't experienced any problems himself, he detects self-segregation and overt discrimination taking place between the various ethnic groups, and expresses wry amusement at the fact that Caucasians in Hawaii are occasionally at the receiving end of prejudice. But if his assessment is relatively clear-eyed, he is careful to end on a happy note. One thing other nations can learn from Hawaii, he says, is the willingness of races to work together towards common development, something he has found whites elsewhere too often unwilling to do. I discovered this article, folded away among my birth certificate and old vaccination forms, when I was in high school. It's a short piece, with a photograph of him. No mention is made of me or my mother, and I'm left to wonder whether the omission was intentional on my father's part, in anticipation of his long departure. Perhaps the reporter failed to ask personal questions, intimidated by my father's imperious manner. Or perhaps it was an editorial decision, not part of the simple story they were looking for. I wonder, too, whether the omission caused a fight between my parents. I would not have known at the time, for I was too young to realize that I was supposed to have a live-in father, just as I was too young to know that I needed a race. For an improbably short span, it seems that my father fell under the same spell as my mother and her parents, and for the first 6 years of my life, even as that spell was broken and the worlds that they thought they'd left behind reclaimed each of them, I occupied the place where their dreams had been. The road to the embassy was choked with traffic. Cars, motorcycles, tricycle rickshaws, buses, and jitneys filled twice to their capacity. A procession of wheels and limbs all fighting for space in the mid-afternoon heat. We nudged forward a few feet, stopped, found an opening, stopped again. Our taxi driver shooed away a group of boys who were hawking gum and loose cigarettes, then barely avoided a motor scooter carrying an entire family on its back. Father, mother, son, and daughter, all leaning as one into a turn, their mouths wrapped with handkerchiefs to blunt the exhaust. A family of bandits. Along the side of the road, wizened brown women in faded brown sarongs stacked straw baskets high with ripening fruit, and a pair of mechanics squatted before their open-air garage, lazily brushing away flies as they took an engine apart. Behind them, the brown earth dipped into a smoldering dump, where a pair of round-headed tots frantically chased a scrawny black hen. The children slipped in the mud and corn husks and banana leaves, squealing with pleasure, until they disappeared down the dirt road beyond. Things eased up once we hit the highway, and the taxi dropped us off in front of the embassy, where a pair of smartly dressed Marines nodded in greeting. Inside the courtyard, the clamor of the street was replaced by the steady rhythm of gardening clippers. My mother's boss was a portly black man with closely cropped hair, sprinkled gray at the temples. An American flag draped down in rich folds from the pole beside his desk. He reached out and offered a firm handshake. "How are you, young man?" He smelled of aftershave and his starched collar cut hard into his neck. I stood at attention as I answered his questions about the progress of my studies. The air in the office was cool and dry, like the air of mountain peaks, the pure and heady breeze of privilege. Our audience over, my mother sat me down in the library while she went off to do some work. I finished my comic books and the homework that my mother had made me bring, before climbing out of my chair to browse through the stacks. Most of the books held little interest for a 9-year-old boy. World Bank reports, geological surveys, 5-year development plans. But in one corner I found a collection of Life magazines, neatly displayed in clear plastic binders. I thumbed through the glossy advertisements. Goodyear Tires and Dodge Fever, Zenith TV, why not the best? And Campbell's Soup, good. Men in white turtlenecks pouring Seagrams over ice as women in red miniskirts looked on admiringly, and felt vaguely reassured. When I came upon a news photograph, I tried to guess the subject of the story before reading the caption. The photograph of French children dashing over cobblestone streets. That was a happy scene, a game of hide-and-go-seek after a day of schoolbooks and chores. Their laughter spoke of freedom. The photograph of a Japanese woman cradling a young naked girl in a shallow tub. That was sad. The girl was sick, her legs twisted, her head fallen back against the mother's breast, the mother's face tight with grief. Perhaps she blamed herself. Eventually, I came across a photograph of an older man in dark glasses and a raincoat walking down an empty road. I couldn't guess what this picture was about. There seemed nothing unusual about the subject. On the next page, there was another photograph, this one a close-up of the same man's hands. They had a strange, unnatural pallor, as if blood had been drawn from the flesh. Turning back to the first picture, I now saw that the man's crinkly hair, his heavy lips and broad, fleshy nose, all had this same uneven, ghostly hue. He must be terribly sick, I thought. A radiation victim, maybe. Or an albino. I had seen one of those on a street a few days before, and my mother had explained about such things. Except when I read the words that went with the picture, that wasn't it at all. The man had received a chemical treatment, the article explained, to lighten his complexion. He had paid for it with his own money. He expressed some regret about trying to pass himself off as a white man, and was sorry about how badly things had turned out. But the results were irreversible. There were thousands of people like him, black men and women back in America, who'd undergone the same treatment in response to advertisements that promised happiness as a white person. I felt my face and neck get hot. My stomach knotted. The type began to blur on the page. Did my mother know about this? What about her boss? Why was he so calm reading through his reports a few feet down the hall? I had a desperate urge to jump out of my seat, to show them what I had learned, to demand some explanation or assurance. But something held me back. As in a dream, I had no voice for my newfound fear. By the time my mother came to take me home, my face wore a smile, and the magazines were back in their proper place. The room, the air, was quiet as before. We had lived in Indonesia for over 3 years by that time, the result of my mother's marriage to an Indonesian named Lolo, another student she had met at the University of Hawaii. His name meant crazy in Hawaiian, which tickled Gramps to no end, but the meaning didn't suit the man, for Lolo possessed the good manners and easy grace of his people. He was short and brown, handsome, with thick black hair and features that could have as easily been Mexican or Samoan as Indonesian. His tennis game was good, his smile uncommonly even, and his temperament imperturbable. For 2 years, from the time that I was 4 until I was 6, he endured endless hours of chess with Gramps and long wrestling sessions with me. When my mother sat me down one day to tell me that Lolo had proposed and wanted us to move with him to a faraway place, I wasn't surprised and expressed no objections. I did ask if she loved him. I had been around long enough to know such things were important. My mother's chin trembled, as it still does when she's fighting back tears, and she pulled me into a long hug that made me feel very brave, although I wasn't sure why. Lolo left Hawaii quite suddenly after that, and my mother and I spent months in preparation. Passports, visas, plane tickets, hotel reservations, an endless series of shots. While we packed, my grandfather pulled out an atlas and ticked off the names in Indonesia's island chain, Java, Borneo, Sumatra, Bali. He remembered some of the names, he said, from reading Joseph Conrad as a boy. The Spice Islands, they were called back then. Enchanted names, shrouded in mystery. Says here they still got tigers over there, he said. And orangutans. He looked up from the book and his eyes widened. Says here they've even got headhunters. Meanwhile, Toot called the State Department to find out if the country was stable. Whoever she spoke to there informed her that the situation was under control. Still, Toot insisted that we packed several trunks full of foodstuffs. Tang, powdered milk, cans of sardines. You never know what these people will eat, she said firmly. My mother sighed, but Toot tossed in several boxes of candy to win me over to her side. Finally, we boarded a Pan Am jet for our flight around the globe. I wore a long-sleeve white shirt and a gray clip-on tie, and the stewardess plied me with puzzles and extra peanuts and a set of metal pilot's wings that I wore over my breast pocket. On a 3-day stopover in Japan, we walked through bone-chilling rains to see the great bronze Buddha at Kamakura and ate green tea ice cream on a ferry that passed through high mountain lakes. In the evenings, my mother studied flashcards. Walking off the plane in Jakarta, the tarmac rippling with heat, the sun bright as a furnace, I clutched her hand, determined to protect her from whatever might come. Lolo was there to greet us, a few pounds heavier, a bushy mustache now hovering over his smile. He hugged my mother, hoisted me up into the air, and told us to follow a small, wiry man who was carrying our luggage, straight past the long line at customs and into an awaiting car. The car was borrowed, Lolo told us, but he had bought a brand new motorcycle, a Japanese make, but good enough for now. The new house was finished, just a few touch-ups remained to be done. I was already enrolled in a nearby school, and the relatives were anxious to meet us. As he and my mother talked, I stuck my head out the backseat window and stared at the passing landscape, brown and green uninterrupted, villages falling back into forest, the smell of diesel oil and wood smoke. Men and women stepped like cranes through the rice paddies, their faces hidden by their wide straw hats. A boy, wet and slick as an otter, sat on the back of a dumb-faced water buffalo, whipping its haunches with a stick of bamboo. The streets became more congested, small stores and markets and men pulling carts loaded with gravel and timber. Then the buildings grew taller, like buildings in Hawaii. Hotel Indonesia, very modern, Lolo said, and the new shopping center, white and gleaming. But only a few were higher than the trees that now cooled the road. When we passed a row of big houses with high hedges and sentry posts, my mother said something I couldn't entirely make out, something about the government and a man named Sukarno. Who's Sukarno? I shouted from the back seat, but Lolo appeared not to hear me. Instead, he touched my arm and motioned ahead of us. Look, he said, pointing upward. There, standing astride the road, was a towering giant at least 10 stories tall, with the body of a man and the face of an ape. That's Hanuman, Lolo said as we circled the statue, the monkey god. I turned around in my seat, mesmerized by the solitary figure, so dark against the sun, poised to leap into the sky as puny traffic swirled around its feet. He's a great warrior, Lolo said firmly, strong as 100 men. When he fights the demons, he's never defeated. The house was in a still-developing area on the outskirts of town. The road ran over a narrow bridge that spanned a wide brown river. As we passed, I could see villagers bathing and washing clothes along the steep banks below. The road then turned from tarmac to gravel to dirt as it wound past small stores and whitewashed bungalows until it finally petered out into the narrow footpath of the kampong. The house itself was modest, stucco and red tile, but it was open and airy, with a big mango tree and a small courtyard in front. As we passed through the gate, Lolo announced that he had a surprise for me, but before he could explain, we heard a deafening howl from high up in the trees. My mother and I jumped back with a start and saw a big hairy creature with a small flat head and long menacing arms drop into a low branch. "A monkey!" I shouted. "An ape," my mother corrected. Lolo drew a peanut from his pocket and handed it to the animal's grasping fingers. "His name is Tata," he said. "I brought him all the way from New Guinea for you." I started to step forward to get a closer look, but Tata threatened to lunge, his dark-ringed eyes fierce and suspicious. I decided to stay where I was. "Don't worry," Lolo said, handing Tata another peanut. "He's on a leash. Come, there's more." I looked up at my mother, and she gave me a tentative smile. In the backyard, we found what seemed like a small zoo. Chickens and ducks running every which way, a big yellow dog with a baleful howl, two birds of paradise, a white cockatoo, and finally two baby crocodiles, half submerged in a fenced-off pond towards the edge of the compound. Lowell stared down at the reptiles. "There were three," he said, "but the biggest one crawled out through a hole in the fence, slipped into somebody's rice field and ate one of the man's ducks. We had to hunt it by torchlight." There wasn't much light left, but we took a short walk down the mud path into the village. Groups of giggling neighborhood children waved from their compounds, and a few barefoot old men came up to shake our hands. We stopped at the common, where one of Lolo's men was grazing a few goats, and a small boy came up beside me holding a dragonfly that hovered at the end of a string. When we returned to the house, the man who had carried our luggage was standing in the backyard with a rust-colored hen tucked under his arm and a long knife in his right hand. He said something to Lolo, who nodded, and called over to my mother and me. My mother told me to wait where I was and sent Lolo a questioning glance. "Don't you think he's a little young?" my mother said. Lolo shrugged and looked down at me. "The boy should know where his dinner is coming from. What do you think, Barry?" I looked at my mother, then turned back to face the man holding the chicken. Lolo nodded again, and I watched the man set the bird down, pinning it gently under one knee and pulling its neck out across a narrow gutter. For a moment the bird struggled, beating its wings hard against the ground, a few feathers dancing up with the wind. Then it grew completely still. The man pulled the blade across the bird's neck in a single smooth motion. Blood shot out in a long crimson ribbon. The man stood up, holding the bird far away from his body, and suddenly tossed it into the air. It landed with a thud, then struggled to its feet, its head lolling grotesquely against its side, its legs pumping wildly in a wide, wobbly circle. I watched as the circle grew smaller, the blood trickling down to a gurgle, until finally the bird collapsed, lifeless on the grass. Lolo rubbed his hand across my head and told me and my mother to go wash up before dinner. The three of us ate quietly, under a dim yellow bulb, chicken stew and rice, and then a dessert of red, hairy-skinned fruit so sweet at the center that only a stomachache could make me stop. Later, lying alone beneath a mosquito net canopy, I listened to crickets chirp under the moonlight and remembered the last twitch of life that I'd witnessed a few hours before. I could barely believe my good fortune. The first thing to remember is how to protect yourself. Lolo and I faced off in the backyard. A day earlier, I had shown up at the house with an egg-sized lump on the side of my head. Lolo had looked up from washing his motorcycle and asked me what had happened, and I told him about my tussle with an older boy who lived down the road. The boy had run off with my friend's soccer ball, I said, in the middle of our game. When I chased after him, the boy picked up a rock. "It wasn't fair," I said, my voice choking with aggrievement. "He had cheated." Lolo had parted my hair with his fingers and silently examined the wound. "It's not bleeding," he said finally, before returning to his chrome. I thought that had ended the matter. But when Lolo came home from work the next day, he had with him two pairs of boxing gloves. They smelled of new leather, the larger pair black, the smaller pair red, the laces tied together and thrown over his shoulder. He now finished tying the laces on my gloves and stepped back to examine his handiwork. My hands dangled at my sides like bulbs at the end of thin stalks. He shook his head and raised the gloves to cover my face. "There," he said. "Keep your hands up." He adjusted my elbows, then crouched into a stance and started to bob. "You want to keep moving, but always stay low. Don't give them a target. How does that feel?" I nodded, copying his movements as best I could. After a few minutes, he stopped and held his palm up in front of my nose. "Okay," he said. "Let's see your swing." This I could do. I took a step back, wound up, and delivered my best shot. His hand barely wobbled. "Not bad," Lolo said. He nodded to himself, his expression unchanged. "Not bad at all." "Ah, but look where your hands are now. What did I tell you? Get them up." I raised my arms, throwing soft jabs at Lolo's palm, and glanced up at him every so often. I realized how familiar his face had become after our 2 years, as familiar as the earth on which we stood. It had taken me less than 6 months to learn Indonesia's language, its customs, and its legends. I had survived chickenpox, measles, and the sting of my teacher's bamboo switches. The children of farmers, servants, and low-level bureaucrats had become my best friends, and together we ran the streets morning and night, hustling odd jobs, catching crickets, battling swift kites with razor-sharp lines. The loser watched his kite soar off with the wind and knew that somewhere other children had formed a long, wobbly train, their heads toward the sky, waiting for their prize to land. With Lolo, I had learned how to eat small green chili peppers raw with dinner, plenty of rice, and away from the dinner table I was introduced to dog meat, tough, snake meat, tougher, and roasted grasshopper, crunchy. Like many Indonesians, Lolo followed a brand of Islam that could make room for the remnants of more ancient, animist, and Hindu faiths. He explained that a man took on the powers of whatever he ate. One day soon, he promised, he would bring home a piece of tiger meat for us to share. That's how things were, one long adventure, the bounty of a young boy's life. In letters to my grandparents, I would faithfully record many of these events, confident that more civilizing packages of chocolate and peanut butter would surely follow. But not everything made its way into my letters. Some things I found too difficult to explain. I didn't tell Toot and Gramps about the face of the man who had come to our door one day, with a gaping hole where his nose should have been, the whistling sound he made as he asked my mother for food. Nor did I mention the time that one of my friends told me in the middle of recess that his baby brother had died the night before of an evil spirit brought in by the wind, the terror that had danced in my friend's eyes for the briefest of moments before he let out a strange laugh and punched my arm and broke into a breathless run. There was the empty look on the face of the farmers the year the rains never came, the stoop in their shoulders as they wandered barefoot through their barren, cracked fields, bending over every so often to crumble earth between their fingers, and their desperation the following year, when the rains lasted for over a month, swelling the rivers and fields until the streets gushed with water and swept as high as my waist, and families scrambled to rescue their goats and their hens, even as chunks of their huts washed away. The world was violent, I was learning, unpredictable, and often cruel. My grandparents knew nothing about such a world, I decided. There was no point in disturbing them with questions they couldn't answer. Sometimes, when my mother came home from work, I would tell her things I had seen or heard, and she would stroke my forehead, listening intently, trying her best to explain what she could. I always appreciated the attention. Her voice, the touch of her hand, defined all that was secure. But her knowledge of floods and exorcisms and cockfights left much to be desired. Everything was as new to her as it was to me, and I would leave such conversations feeling that my questions had only given her unnecessary cause for concern. So it was to Lolo that I turned for guidance and instruction. He didn't talk much, but he was easy to be with. With his family and friends, he introduced me as his son, but he never pressed things beyond matter-of-fact advice or pretended that our relationship was more than it was. I appreciated this distance. It implied a manly trust. And his knowledge of the world seemed inexhaustible. Not just how to change a flat tire or open in chess. He knew more elusive things, ways of managing the emotions I felt, ways to explain fate's constant mysteries. Like how to deal with beggars. They seemed to be everywhere, a gallery of ills, men, women, children, in tattered clothing matted with dirt, some without arms, others without feet, victims of scurvy or polio or leprosy, walking on their hands or rolling down the crowded sidewalks in jerry-built carts, their legs twisted behind them like contortionists. At first, I watched my mother give over her money to anyone who stopped at our door or stretched out an arm as we passed on the streets. Later, when it became clear that the tide of pain was endless, she gave more selectively, learning to calibrate the levels of misery. Lolo thought her moral calculations endearing but silly, and whenever he caught me following her example with the few coins in my possession, he would raise his eyebrows and take me aside. "How much money do you have?" he would ask. I'd empty my pocket. 30 rupiah? How many beggars are there on the street? I tried to imagine the number that had come by the house in the last week. "You see," he said, once it was clear I'd lost count, "better to save your money and make sure you don't end up on the street yourself." He was the same way about servants. They were mostly young villagers, newly arrived in the city, often working for families not much better off than themselves, sending money to their people back in the country or saving enough to start their own businesses. If they had ambition, Lolo was willing to help them get their start, and he would generally tolerate their personal idiosyncrasies. For over a year, he employed a good-natured young man who liked to dress up as a woman on weekends. Lolo loved the man's cooking, but he would fire the servants without compunction if they were clumsy or forgetful or otherwise cost him money, and he would be baffled when either my mother or I tried to protect them from his judgment. "Your mother has a soft heart," Lolo would tell me one day after my mother tried to take the blame for knocking a radio off the dresser. "That's a good thing in a woman. But you will be a man someday, and a man needs to have more sense." It had nothing to do with good or bad, he explained, like or dislike. It was a matter of taking life on its own terms. I felt a hard knock to the jaw and looked up at Lolo's sweating face. "Pay attention," he said. "Keep your hands up." We sparred for another half hour before Lolo decided it was time for a rest. My arms burned. My head flashed with a dull, steady throb. We took a jug full of water and sat down near the crocodile pond. "Tired?" he asked. I slumped forward, barely nodding. He smiled and rolled up one of his pants legs to scratch his calf. I noticed a series of indented scars that ran up his ankle, halfway up his shin. "What are those?" I asked. "Leech marks," he said, "from when I was in New Guinea. They crawl inside your army boots while you're hiking through the swamps. At night, when you take off your socks, they're stuck there, fat with blood. You sprinkle salt on them, and they die, but you still have to dig them out with a hot knife." I ran my finger over one of the oval grooves. It was smooth and hairless where the skin had been singed. I asked Lolo if it had hurt. "Of course it hurt," he said, taking a sip from the jug. "Sometimes you can't worry about hurt. Sometimes you worry only about getting where you have to go." We felt silent, and I watched him out of the corner of my eye. I realized then that I had never heard him talk about what he was feeling. I had never seen him really angry or sad. He seemed to inhabit a world of hard surfaces and well-defined thoughts. A queer notion suddenly sprang into my head. "Have you ever seen a man killed?" I asked him. He glanced down, surprised by the question. "Have you?" I asked again. "Yes," he said. "Was it bloody?" "Yes." I thought for a moment. "Why was the man killed? The one you saw?" "Because he was weak." "That's all?" Lolo shrugged and rolled his pants leg back down. "That's usually enough. Men take advantage of weakness in other men. They're just like countries in that way. The strong man takes the weak man's land. He makes the weak man work in his fields. If the weak man's woman is pretty, the strong man will take her." He paused to take another sip of water, then asked, "Which would you rather be?" I didn't answer, and Lolo squinted up at the sky. "Better to be strong," he said finally, rising to his feet. "If you can't be strong, be clever, and make peace with someone who's strong. But always better to be strong yourself. Always." My mother watched us from inside the house, propped up at her desk, grading papers. "What are they talking about?" she wondered to herself. "Blood and guts, probably. Swallowing nails. Cheerful, manly things." She laughed aloud, then caught herself. That wasn't fair. She really was grateful for Lolo's solicitude toward me. He wouldn't have treated his own son very differently. She knew that she was lucky for Lolo's basic kindness. She set her papers aside and watched me do push-ups, He's growing so fast, she thought. She tried to picture herself on the day of our arrival, a mother of 24 with a child in tow, married to a man whose history, whose country, she barely knew. She had known so little then, she realized now. Her innocence carried right alongside her American passport. Things could have turned out worse. Much worse. She had expected it to be difficult, this new life of hers. Before leaving Hawaii, she had tried to learn all that she could about Indonesia, the population, fifth in the world, with hundreds of tribes and dialects, the history of colonialism, first the Dutch for over three centuries, then the Japanese during the war, seeking control over vast stores of oil, metal, and timber, the fight for independence after the war, and the emergence of a freedom fighter named Sukarno as the country's first president. Sukarno had recently been replaced, but all the reports said it was a bloodless coup, and that the people supported the change. Sukarno had grown corrupt, they said. He was a demagogue, totalitarian, too comfortable with the communists. A poor country, underdeveloped, utterly foreign, this much she had known. She was prepared for the dysentery and fevers, the cold water baths and having to squat over a hole in the ground to pee, the electricity's going out every few weeks, the heat and the endless mosquitoes. Nothing more than inconveniences, really. And she was tougher than she looked, tougher than even she had known herself to be. And anyway, that was part of what had drawn her to Lolo after Barack had left. The promise of something new and important, helping her husband rebuild a country in a charged and challenging place, beyond her parents' reach. But she wasn't prepared for the loneliness. It was constant, like a shortness of breath. There was nothing definite that she could point to, really. Lolo had welcomed her warmly and gone out of his way to make her feel at home, providing her with whatever creature comforts he could afford. His family had treated her with tact and generosity and treated her son as one of their own.
Context of white supremacy. I will give out the number 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6. If you have comments, if you would like to participate, again, I will encourage, chime in. These are supposed to be book clubs, exchange of views, just hearing what different people think they have to say. President Barack Obama, his autobiography published in 1996, Dreams from My Father. I will go, we had two of the folks that were on before. Their line should be open. Before I check with them, I'll just toss in a literary moment when he is talking about his grandfather, white grandfather, when they were going to be moving from Hawaii, Barack Obama and his white mother and his grandfather. He said that his knowledge of this new area of the world with mostly non-white people was informed by Joseph Conrad. Joseph Conrad, white man, racist suspect, his most famous writing, Heart of Darkness. I think that book is what the film Apocalypse Now is based on. But it's just white people going to the continent of Africa, practicing racism, and writing about it. The Heart of Darkness, the Congo specifically, very famous book, very important text in racism and white supremacy, has influenced the thinking of many, many white people, continues even to this day. I think that's another one of those white people would see that. They know Joseph Conrad. They know Heart of Darkness. Think of the Prince. The callers that are on with us already, our Skype caller and Paz, your two lines should be open. I'll open up other folks if I see hands.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
It's interesting. You did a program a while back about an Opie and Anthony show where they were talking about Africa, and it seemed like the grandfather's comments were very similar about Indonesia you know, they're headhunters and bring food because you don't know what they eat there. I mean, his grandfather could have had his own Opie and Anthony show.
The Heart of Darkness. I mean, that's that would have been the earlier version of Opie and Anthony. Joseph Conrad. Joseph Conrad, Heart of Darkness. Suggesting that the non-white people, they might be cannibals, I thought.
Yeah, I saw that.
He said they were headhunters.
I'll mute my line. Thought somebody sounded like they had something they were going to add.
Oh, no, I was just saying the same thing that the other guy said.
I thought it was real interesting right when the second segment began, and he was talking about how his white grandfather, he might have made up those stories about what happened with the racists picking on his daughter for playing with the black child. I thought that was real interesting. I think the way he phrased it was white revisionism. And he said that his white grandfather, he believed his fictions. He believed his lies. Like, that's what he said. I thought that was fascinating. Just that whole segment about his white grandfather. Did you all remember the segment I'm talking about?
Yes. I was thinking the same thing. I was thinking if he believes his grandfather's telling fiction, then how can I be crazy for suspecting this for being fiction too?
Yeah, I remember a conversation, Gus, that you had with Mr. Fuller. And you asked him, why do white people lie to themselves? And then he commented, he said, they're not lying to themselves because if they were delusional, they couldn't practice racism, white supremacy. They're lying to you. And it seems like this is a perfect example where the grandfather was so convincing, you know, that even though Barack doubted him, he still said, well, he believes it's true. Which could have been another form of deception.
Please, white people, confuse non-white people. See if I can steal that and say that I said that. I mean, that's like every page. And I feel like even, and we've only heard a little bit. We pretty much just heard disc one in the set. So this is probably going to take 4 additional weeks. I feel like so many of the things that he's sharing that his white grandfather and white grandmother said to him, these are standard things that white people say to non-white people to try to convince them that they're not racist. Oh, I have Cherokee in my family. Oh, we didn't do that. We allowed our children to play, you know, with non-white people, black people. We didn't have a problem with that at all. These are standard things. We have my great-great-grandmother was an abolitionist. My great-great-grandfather fought and said these are standard things that white people say to disarm people that they intend to mistreat, non-white people.
And, you know, this is kind of off topic, what you were saying, but I just noticed that his mom, you know, she get down with the chocolate.
Maximum racist aggression.
It reminded me of Renepia Tate, Pieces of a Puzzle, this Sunday evening, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, where she said that she's talking about white men, but they will have adventures where they go off explore and have their fun sexually trashing non-white people. I was thinking that seems to apply to his white mother. These seem like adventures, sexual escapades for his white mother. Go ahead.
I just want to add across the planet. I thought it was real interesting towards the end of the little, but the story in Indonesia, how Lolo started to not really mess with his mom anymore. Like, he started to have reservations. I wonder what that was all about.
I'm not sure. I don't recall if they go into more details about that. I guess that's what we'll be picking up next Friday. For this, if they go into more details about that, the dissolution of that so-called relationship.
See, I don't know. Maybe I read, I don't know if I read too far. Did y'all reach chapter 3?
I'm not sure how the audiobook matches up with the chapters. I would have to look to see how they match up. I know with the audiobook, we pretty much did disc 1, and they divide that into like 19 different segments. So I'm not sure how far along that would put you in the book. And again, this is abridged, so I'm not sure how that would match up to where you'd be in the text.
Okay, so I was just reading. I find it easier to read it, so I was reading. But yeah, I thought that was interesting how so he wouldn't speak to her, and he just, you know, didn't really talk to her, but he spent a lot of time talking to Barack.
I just saw Dinesh D'Souza, hope I'm saying his name correctly, his documentary, 2016, Obama's America, and he goes to sections from Dreams from My Father, and he plays portions from the audiobook, and he gives his own opinion on why President Obama's white mother left this second non-white male, Lolo, why she left him. And what that says, check that out if you're interested. I also wanted to make sure that I brought up the portion about Mr. Reed. His grandma, Toots, white grandmother, where she's on the job, and I think this was in the first audio segment, where the white person tells her she's not supposed to say mister to those niggers. And she goes and she talks it over with her husband, President Obama's grandfather. She talks it over with him, and she decides she's going to keep calling him Mr. Reed. And then it picks up later, he's crying, and, you know, why do white people treat us so bad? And later on in the second audio segment, President Obama, he says, he compares Mr. Reed to a prop in someone else's narrative. And I just thought, wow, that is really interesting to say that. That's exactly the way it's written, Mr. Reed compared to a prop in someone else's narrative. And I was thinking, wow, that... It almost suggests, like you all keep saying, that this sounds phony. This sounds like, you know, just something that they cooked up to push this racial showcasing project over on us to confuse non-white people. Just saying that, it almost sounds like, it suggests, should I be thinking maybe this was just included as a story? Maybe this didn't even happen? Maybe you just made all this up about this Mr. Reed incident and how she handled it and the conversation between her and Gramps? And I mean, I thought it was real interesting. Do y'all remember, you know what I'm talking about?
I remember that, but I actually did not catch that. That's actually a good catch. Yeah, that's a classic literary tool, you know, using pretending things in the early or revealing truth in small snippets, and you have to be kind of told that it's there.
Was he telling the story from his parents' perspective, or was it his perspective on their story? Like, who's it was difficult to determine. You know, if he was commenting on it, or was he saying he was giving a portrayal of how they saw it? His mom and or grandfather.
I've been confused about that since the beginning, so I think that may be, you know, a byproduct of this whole book.
Can you restate that? Just what's your confusion about the perspective?
It was difficult to determine whether he was looking at what his parents said and commenting on it, or he was taking the side. It seemed like he was on his parents' side. Like he didn't relate to the other, you know, that black male being mistreated. It's sort of like he looked at him as a tragic character, like, oh, that's just so unfortunate. And it seems like that's something that, you know, white people would do if they saw a non-white person being mistreated. Oh, how unfortunate. But it's no real concern for that individual.
I see what you're saying, but I was going a little bit deeper. Like, how does he have recollection of these events? And if he doesn't, whose recollection is this?
Yeah. Gus, do you know, whose recollection is that?
That segment, the one about Mr. Reed, and then Toots and Grant having a dialogue about this, I would think that couldn't be his recollection. I would think he wouldn't be in on that conversation. Like, I haven't read anything. I don't have evidence that provides detail about, you know, is this, did he have a conversation with somebody about this, and he's just given what they said, this is what they told him about what happened, or was he involved, or, you know, how, what perspective you're getting on all this. I have not seen details on that, but it does not surprise me. I think that is a product, even in this case with, you know, the racial showcasing project that I suspect this could be, but even if that wasn't the case, just when you have a non-white person who has a white parent, I think this is a product of that, where that non-white offspring, they frequently take on the perspective, the worldview, the umawazo of white people. I mean, that I've seen that happen over and over again.
Yeah, I think it was very evident when he started describing what his mother would be thinking while he was playing with Lolo. And I was like, now who wrote that? He had a scene where his mom is talking about, I wonder what they're doing or what they're talking about, probably manly things. So I'm like, is he trying to predict what his mom was thinking, or was that the part his mom wrote? I was very confused.
Mr. Fuller. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I would just point out, maybe, you know, how Gus pointed out the when he mentioned a prop of someone's story or something like that, maybe the revisionism quote is a subliminal to the whole, you know, whose perspective it is.
I remember while I didn't have my computer, I was able to listen to some of the archives, and I heard Mr. Fuller on the program with Cleo Monago, and he was talking about confusion. One of the ways that racists generate confusion is by blurring boundaries so that you don't have a clearly defined understanding. And he was given the analogy of a highway. you have the lines on the road. So you have clear boundaries. And he said what racists will do is just come along and erase all the lines. And he said, you know how dangerous a highway is if it's not marked, liable to have an accident. Same thing here. Difficult to grasp which perspective. Is this mom talking? Is this just mom came in and said, you know, this is what I want to go in the story, and she's saying it? Is this him remembering a previous conversation? Blurred boundaries. Who is the actual speaker here?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, Gus and other callers. This is Blacker. Hey, Gus, I think it would be better for me to relay that story on tomorrow's program. The flow of this one is just too good to slow it down with that. But outside of that, you know, my experience with the Asians, and I do mean all of them, I'm finding it hard to believe this story. You know, because it's just too nice. It's just too neat. You know how he was accepted in to this foreign land, and everybody just, you know, he was almost embraced, and his stepfather just took him in. I'm just finding it too hard to believe. And the other stories of him and his with his grandparents being in Kansas and then Hawaii. I mean, even though it was a bit bumpy, I don't know. Maybe I'm just getting old and cynical. But it's just it's hard for me to believe. It's just too nice, even with the little rough patches. It's just too nice for me.
I just want to say, man, if you feel that way, maybe I'm not crazy, because that's precisely why I suspected. You know, that's why I used the word hoax. It may not have been the most accurate word, but. You know, I was thinking the same thing. This is too nicely packaged.
Yeah, we all know how Asians are with people who look like us. And it just ain't going to happen like that. Well, my experience anyway. It's just not going to happen like that. But I could be wrong.
I did see a news report just this week where they were saying in 2008, Indonesia, that they were all super supportive of President Obama since he had spent that time there, and they looked at him as one of theirs. I did see that this week. Could be false. Does that mean anything to you? Nothing at all, Blacker?
Let's me and you go over there and see how we get treated. I'm going to tell you, and I grew up in the South. I'm from the South. I'm Southern. And like I relayed this story several times before, the worst racism I've ever experienced in my life was in Japan. It was just crazy. It was only 2 weeks, and that's the worst I had in my life. I just know those people aren't going to be that open-armed to anybody that don't look like them. They're really xenophobic. Of course, it could be different, and I think he's in Indonesia. It could be different there. It could be, but I don't think so.
Hey, Blacker, can I ask you just one question? Do you think him having a white mother in that time period had, you know, may have limited the xenophobia?
I've thought about that, and I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure if he was with his mother, he could have sidestepped some of it. But as far as in school and, you know, out in public, running around with the other children, I don't think so. I don't think so.
Okay,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I would just to bring more accuracy, since I use the word xenophobia, that means, you know, dislike of other. This sounds more like anti-blackness, so maybe we should use that term instead.
Well, I mean, I would if it was here. If it was in America, I would probably say anti-blackness. But since I think they have a different dynamic completely, so there would be, I would consider xenophobia. And they are highly xenophobic, but of course they worship white skin like, you know, the rest of the planet. And, you know, like I said, all I can go on is my is the time that I spent in Japan, which is not all that far away from Indonesia. And it was incredible. But I am dark skinned, so that could make the difference also.
What are some things you experienced in Japan? Oh, I'm sorry.
Excuse me.
I just wanted to ask the caller what are some things he experienced in Japan that were really that you felt were really racist.
I'll try to keep it short. The one incident I had where a guy came up to me. It was me and another guy. He was from Miami. Both of us, we were over 6 feet. He was a little bit lighter than I am, but he was still dark skinned. And some little guy was in a shop we were in, and we were just looking around. And he came and asked us. He spoke English. He came and asked us if is it true that black people grow tails at night? You know, I'd never heard that before, and I just thought he was joking. And I said, yeah. I can't remember what I said. I probably said yes, knowing how it was then. And the other thing is, you always get you when you're walking down the street or when you go into a shop or anywhere, you always feel like someone touching your skin. They're always rubbing your skin. And I was told that they were rubbing your skin to see if the color comes off. And this is in 85. It wasn't that long ago. You know, nobody's that ignorant. But yeah, they rub your skin to see if the color came off. And outside of that, it was just the vibe was really closed down to us. And we also stood out like giants because, you know, I don't think anybody was over 5'4 then. We were over 6 feet, like I said. And we just stood out. And we were just completely like monsters. And we were like Godzilla and Megalon, or that other monster they got there. And we were just, it was a rough experience for me. The vibe was just really oppressive. And they're really open about it too, because you know they don't have to do it that often. So when they do it, it's just like out in the open.
Last 5 minutes.
yeah, that's probably about it. It's some vulgar things too, but I won't mention that either. But it was just the vibe. I think it was the total vibe of the country and the xenophobia that you can feel.
Well, I can relate a personal story. I mean, I went last week. I went to a Filipino restaurant. Well, not a restaurant, more like a deli. And I bought a bunch of Filipino food because I have some Filipino friends. When I went to the cashier, she started speaking to me in Tagalog, and then she asked me where I was from. She thought I was Filipino. And just looking at Barack, it's possible that. Just if you looked at him from a distance, he could be mistaken for an Indonesian.
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Of course, I don't know what he looked like back then.
Yeah.
So you're not in the States.
Filipinos, you had some very dark Indonesians, I think, as well.
Yeah, but it's they know themselves, and I think it'll be the hair would be the giveaway and the features. I don't think they have the same features. I work with a couple of Vietnamese older man and an older woman, and you know, we have a lot of images coming through, and they can always point out who's Japanese, Indonesian, who's Chinese, what part of China, what part of Japan, what part of Vietnam. North or South Korea, and they could always tell who is who off the top. So I'm sure it would be the same thing in Indonesia. Oh, one thing else too, guys. You know, I really wanted to hear the last part of Turner Diaries, but I just could not do it. I couldn't stand that dude's voice no more. I just couldn't listen to the last part.
Well, I think President Obama is a little easier to listen to. I'm thankful I was able to tough it out with Turner Diaries because I'm seeing a lot of what was in the book, even related to President Obama with my man Alex Jones talking about black people rioting should President Obama lose the election, which I don't think is going to happen.
Please bring it up tomorrow.
I will be sure to do so. I will say real quick two things that also stood out to me. The scene where President Obama has the magazine on the skin bleaching. He looks at it. At first he thinks it's an albino. And he says he gets angry. He wants information. He wants an explanation. He wanted his mom or somebody. You owe me an explanation here. What is this? And then he put it down and just let it go. The confusion. What? White people are pleased. Non-white people are confused. And this is one of those incidents where I would kind of keep in mind with President Obama. I'm not blaming him. He's not in charge. I suspect this is racial showcasing.
Right.
Victim of racism. Can you imagine being a non-white person? And your first time learning about skin bleaching, what that is, what it looks like, your first time learning about that on the planet, and you have a white mother.
And you're in Indonesia.
Also, that term WAP, it popped back up in the second audio segment. What he was saying when he was talking about his grandfather and how he really knew the deal. We're on a system of white supremacy and that he was not a fair-haired boy. He was a WAP. Words. They reveal so much. Anything else? Folks, get up. Before we wrap up, anything else?
Yeah, don't they have a term for those Southern Italians? Is it Dago? Is that a for the Italians?
Yep, Dago WAP. They connect them sometimes.
Okay, that's what I thought. Because that's what I was used to them being called. I don't think I've ever used it, but that's what I was used to them being called was Dago. Oh, one thing too, Gus. Before you close out the Alex Jones thing. Whoever's listening to that, I would just, if you have any kind of history with Alex Jones, I would take that with a passing breeze. He's a long time fearmonger, and hardly anything he says ever comes to pass. He just fearmongers, and he gets, I don't know what he's making. I'm sure he's making a really good living fearmongering.
White people are able to do that well. Absolutely. We will be doing this again next Friday, same time, 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central, 4 p.m. Pacific. We'll be on disc 2. If you have the audiobook, I'll be looking at the book, The Unabridged. If listeners out there, anyone that's reading, that would be great. Any segments that you read in the book and you don't hear it in the audiobook, bring that up, because I feel like we're missing a lot. We got to be. It should be probably twice the size. The audiobook should probably be at least 10 discs if it was, you know, equal to the size of the book. So, you know, we got to be missing a lot. I will try to contribute. If you're reading, highlight, take notes, and share. Would definitely like to make note of that. I'm real certain white supremacy, the term, is used in the book. We'll keep our ears alert, see if it comes up in the audio book. Next week for that, tomorrow, compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Dial in, can catch up the Alex Jones situation, the BBC situation, looking forward to that. And then on Sunday, Renithia Tate, Pieces of a Puzzle, Wowee. White men, black females, sexual intercourse. Very informative. If you know any black females that might need some information on this, might be more receptive to hearing a black female who's been in this situation talk about her research and interviews with white men and black females talking candidly about this subject matter, tune in on Sunday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, Renithia Tate, Pieces of a Puzzle. I'm pretty sure, white people permitting, Pam will probably chime in on that one. She has been looking forward to hearing from Ms. Tate for a long time, like years. We've been trying to make this happen. So I'm sure you'll hear from her Sunday, too. Thank you, everybody, tuning in to the program. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Friday evening. We'll be back. Hopefully, we'll have Blacker. He'll give us his story tomorrow as well. Be looking forward to that. Share, put it on Facebook, Twitter, any social media sites, link the program. The archives are on iTunes. The archives are on iTunes. This program will be on iTunes. It takes a while to update the feed. I think they do it at like midnight or sometime at night, but it'll probably be on iTunes by tomorrow. You'll be able to download it today. I'll put the link on my Facebook page, facebook.com/ The Problem is White People. I put it on my Facebook page. You can download it that way. If you want to find it on iTunes, you can just do a search for The Cows. You can put in white supremacy. You can put in racism. The way that might be easiest, The Cows. When I do it, I put the periods in. So C period, O period, W period, S period. If you do it that way, it'll pop up. The current feed is the one that has the image of TalkShoe. I didn't change it because I'm not trying to attract attention from the racists at TalkShoe. But if you click that one, it will have the D.K. Wilson program, last week's compensatory call-in, the final Turner Diaries study session. This program will be added today. So I'll post the feed again on Facebook, Twitter. If you have any confusion, shoot me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. On Twitter, @untiljustice. Invest in the program. Link is on my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal account, top right corner. Invest. We definitely appreciate it. Justice's blog, justdojusticetoday.blogspot.com. We will be back tomorrow. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to the broadcast. Context of White Supremacy, signing out. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. It has been time. Thanks for listening in.
White people.